This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with U.S. Air Force Colonel retired Harold Hal Austin. Today is 6 September 2012. I'm in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and the Colonel is kind enough to join me by phone from his home in California. Colonel, to begin this interview, I'd like to get some biographical information from you, if I may. Could you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born 8/28/1924.
And where were you born, sir?
I just had a birthday a week ago.
Yes, you did. Happy birthday, by the way.
Yeah.
Where were you born?
Born in Sweetwater. Well, I was actually born in the country, but the mailing address was Sweetwater, Oklahoma.
And what were your parents' names?
I'm sorry?
What were your parents' names?
My parents, Mom was only 16 when I was born.
Hmm.
Dad was 18. And my dad was a sharecropper.
Hmm.
And when I was 5 years old, we moved from Roger Mills County, Oklahoma, when I was 5 years old, to Brownfield, Texas, and where Dad initially worked for a dollar a day. This was in the 30s, of course, or late 20s and 30s. And then he had a chance to rent a farm as a sharecropper. And he only had a fourth grade education. My mom had a sixth grade education. When she was 50 years old, she got her high school diploma, and it was the greatest day of her life.
Hmm.
But anyway, excuse me, I was raised on the farm, and typical of the World War II guys, a lot of us raised on the farm, and we never got back to farming.
Right. Tell me about life growing up there, primarily in the Brownfield area.
Well, yeah, our farm was actually 12 miles south of Brownfield in the country. I started school when I was 6 years old at a town called Wellman. The school is still there, not the school I went to, but it was a one-room schoolhouse. I rode a Shetland pony both ways, 5 miles from our house to the school each way. And then in the fourth and fifth grade, I was transferred to another school that's long gone, Hunter, where I rode a horse then. I upgraded to a horse. And then we moved to another farm a mile and a half out of Brownfield. And I went to junior high school and high school in Brownfield, Texas. Graduated in May of 1941. I was 16 then. Mom put me through first and second grade in 1 year. Texas only had 11 grades through high school in those days, and so I was 16 when I graduated in May of 1941.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, I'm the oldest of six kids. I have a sister that's 7 years younger than I am, and two brothers. One brother 10 years younger, another 14 years younger, and then my other two sisters. Mom lost a couple of babies between me and my oldest sister, and after that, my sister, then brother, sister, brother, and then sister's the youngest. They were roughly 2 years apart.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about growing up there. Were you working with your father on the farm as a
young man? Oh, yes. I was driving a team of horses by the time I was 9 years old, two horses pulling a plow. My mom worked in the field quite a bit in those days, too. But I spent a lot of time milking cows. Dad had quite a few cows. A hired hand and I, and he milked 32 cows at one point in time and sold the milk in town. So all the farm stuff. Mom always had a nice garden. And so all the things associated with horses and mules. And later, when we moved to Brownfield, Texas, Dad was able to use the farm all tractor. But up to that time, we farmed with mules and horses.
Hmm. Now, was this primarily cotton farming?
Money crop was cotton. Of course, for all of our animals and so forth, raised a lot of feed. But the sharecropper worked on the third and fourth, which I'm sure in Texas, you understand what that is.
Yes, sir.
A third of the money crop went to the landlord, and a fourth of the feed crop went to the landlord.
Mm-hmm. Now, what can you tell me about your memories of the Great Depression? Born in 1924, you would have been a young child, obviously, during the Great Depression. What do you remember about that time?
Well, you know, I've done more thinking in the recent years than I did at the time, I think. But my mom always had a garden, and so we lived a lot out of that garden. My family never wanted for a meal. We always had plenty of food to eat, that sort of thing. So from that standpoint, we never felt the depression being on a farm like we were. But of course, mom and dad had the kids, my brothers and sisters during that time frame as well. But we got along good. Like I say, never hungry. Always plenty of food, and we got by. My mom and dad were for no formal education to speak of. They did a fantastic job. My dad was a quick learner, he was honest to a fault, and that's how he got along. And so I have no bad recollections at all of the Depression.
Hmm. Now, when one thinks of the Great Depression, out in western Texas, and that's part of the world, the Dust Bowl storms come to mind. Do you recall any of that?
Not really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, tell me about your education. Tell me about the schools that you went to and the...
I graduated from Brownfield High School in 1941 and then enrolled in the College of Mines in El Paso. And my grandmother, my dad's mom, lived in El Paso. Mm-hmm. College of Mines in El Paso, now University of Texas, El Paso. And I got a job at a motel court as a night clerk and rode a streetcar from that court to school at the College of Mines. Then later got a better job, better paying job at another resort hotel on the west side of El Paso. So I went to school for two semesters. And of course, I always wanted to fly airplanes. When they dropped the requirement of 2 years of college to go in the Army Air Corps Aviation Cadet Program, I signed up.
Hmm.
My dad didn't forgive me for a few years for doing that because I helped him in between schools, of course, mm-hmm. back and forth. And by the way, he and Mom moved from Brownfield, Texas, to the Members River north of Deming, New Mexico.
Okay.
He had a deal there for not only farming but able to raise cows and so forth. So they moved there. I stayed in Brownfield for my senior year in high school and stayed with a friend of mine and his mom and dad and finished high school in Brownfield before going to College of Mines, and then of course my folks had already moved out to New Mexico. It's only about 100 miles from El Paso to where mom and dad lived, and so I helped them in between semesters and that sort of thing. And of course the summer of 42 started school in the fall of 42, and they dropped the requirement to high school education for aviation cadet program. So, and I went in reserves in the spring of 43, and was called on the 3rd of September of 43 Army aviation cadet program.
Now, you mentioned that you had always been interested in flying. Where did this interest come from?
Well, my dad always had a full-time hired hand when we lived down south of Brownfield. Well, he had a hired hand up at Brownfield, too. But anyway, always had at least one hired hand. Well, my mom had two brothers. One of them spent quite a bit of time as our primary hired hand. The other one was out one summer. And when the barnstormers were working, the barnstormers were flying around and landing in cornfields and that sort of thing. Well, my mom's younger brother, Cecil, heard about that. So we rode horseback, which was not unusual in those days either, all the way to Brownfield when we knew that the barnstormers coming in. So my uncle then paid $5. For about a 10 or 15 minute ride at the most I was in the back seat of a, I don't have any idea what airplane it was, maybe in a Jenny. But anyway, one of those World War One Barnstormers were flying, and from that point on, I was hooked. I was probably about 10 years old when that occurred.
Right. Now, you graduated high school in the spring of 1941, you mentioned.
In May of 41, huh?
Were you aware of what was going on in the world in terms of the lead-up to and the early progress of the Second World War?
Well, probably. Probably about as much as a farmer's kid would.
Mm-hmm.
We heard quite a bit. Dad got a radio when I was, still in junior high school, probably, operated off a car battery and a wind charger. And so we used to listen to the news in those days. So, yes, I was following to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhat aware for a guy that is 15, 16 years old, yeah.
Did you have any interest in joining the military as a result of what you were hearing about the war?
Yes, because I knew there was a lot of talk about building airplanes and that sort of thing to get into that we'd get into war and so on. Well, I wanted to fly by the time I was about 10, 11 years old, whenever I had that experience in Jenny or whatever it was. So I was attuned to anything to do with flying.
Mm-hmm. Now, again, you graduate in the spring of 1941, of course.
Uh-huh.
Pearl Harbor is attacked by the Japanese in December of 1941. What were your memories of the attack on Pearl Harbor?
Okay, I was working, I told you I was working at a resort hotel by that time.
Mm-hmm.
in 41. And I remember the 7th of December distinctly from this standpoint. I had a chance to once in a while to go to a movie. We had a station wagon that we ran back and forth to El Paso from that resort hotel. And so a couple of us went, a couple of the guys, another guy and I, they were also in college. They dropped us off downtown that Sunday morning, and we were going to a movie. And I heard a radio, and we walked by a business of some kind, and I heard the radio going on about the bombing in Hawaii. I remember that very distinctly. And he and I looked at each other, and oh, my God, so that was my consciousness of it. We went on to the movie, by the way, that day.
Hmm. Now, had anyone in your family served in the military prior to the Second World War?
No. I don't. I tried to trace my family's history back. By the way, my Austin family came through Michigan probably from England. Never could get back that far back on my family tree, but... To my knowledge, there was none of my immediate family on either side. Mom and Dad's family had done anything in the military.
Mm-hmm. So with this as background, you're attending school there in El Paso. What was your course of study at the School of Mines?
Even in those days, you didn't have to decide what you're going to do. So I had the basic math, English, and the other courses, I don't remember now. But for your first 2 years in college, even those days, I had not decided what I wanted to try to do.
Mm-hmm. But other than the fact that you wanted to fly, you knew that for a fact.
Well, I wanted to fly from way back when, but there was no classes available at that stage of the game to do that, other than math and science, which was always, even in those days, to get involved with aviation, math and science was important.
Mm-hmm. Now, how well were you doing in your studies there in El Paso?
Oh, I was barely between a C and a B average. I was not... I don't think I ever was very good at studying. I don't know how come I got by so well as I did, because ultimately, while I was in the military, I got a bachelor's degree and then a master's degree after that.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you keep up with the progress of the war once the U.S. entered the war?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I sure did. Very, very conscious. My dad, especially, was tuned to that sort of thing. That's why he's a quick learner. He was he read a lot and followed news and that sort of thing. So yes, I listened a lot. I really admired my dad.
Mm-hmm. Now, was the military something that you wanted to get involved with while you were going to school?
Other than flying airplanes, I'm sure that if World War II had not come along, I would have never been in a position to become a pilot in the Air Force. Mm-hmm. World War II is the only thing that afforded that for me.
Right.
Sure, I wanted to fly, but there was no way I'd ever made it if it hadn't been for World War II.
Right. Now, you mentioned that the Army dropped the requirement of a college education for...
Two years of college.
2 years of college, I'm sorry. Two years of college.
Yeah, the high school diploma.
I'm sorry, please, go ahead.
No, I just said that occurred in the spring of 43, as I recall.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, the day that happened, I signed up I had a deferment. I had a college deferment and a farming deferment also from the military.
Mm-hmm.
But the day that I heard that the aviation jet program had been dropped from 2 years of college to high school diploma, that's when I signed up with the draft board in Deming, New Mexico, and said I'm available for aviation cadet training.
And did they call you up immediately?
No, I didn't call me up until, I don't remember the exact date I got called, but my reporting date was the 3rd of September 1943 at Fort Bliss, Texas for a physical.
All right, now, we've entered the stage where you're now going to be in the U.S. Army. We've got World War II raging both in Europe and in the Pacific. Take me through your earliest Army experiences from the time that you showed up at Fort Bliss. Take me through basic training, for example.
Okay. The physical, we stayed in a tent city at Fort Bliss, and I don't recall exactly anymore, but we were there for probably a couple of weeks. Went by train then to Shepherd Field, Texas at Wichita Falls,
mm-hmm.
and went through basic training. For all of us, all of us that did not have 2 years of college, they had the college training detachments in various places. So after I finished basic training, I went to Cole College, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for CTD or college training detachment. And while there, I don't recall exactly when it occurred, but we were a couple of months into our training there, which normally was about six to 7 months. And we had a streptococcus infection hit the cadet program. As I recall, we had 400 cadets there. I don't remember the exact number, but something in that neighborhood. And I was one of 20 that never got sick.
Mm.
So we wound up being helped with the nursing a little bit to take care of all the guys. And as a result, we slipped from class 44K to 45B, really three classes in the cadet program. Because we were out of school, stopped for a month or 6 weeks. I don't remember the times exactly. But from there, when we finished the college training detachment, I was sent by train 7 days en route. I remember that very distinctly.
Mm-hmm.
To Santa Ana, California, for pre-flight,
mm-hmm.
rather, for pre-flight training. And we had the first time we were able to get off the train was in Riverside, California, never knowing that eventually I'd live here.
Right.
But we were allowed, half the guys on the train were allowed to get off and stretch our legs a little bit and around town. And then the other half got off, and then we proceeded about 6 hours in Riverside, proceeded on to Santa Ana. Went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana, and then was assigned to Lancaster, California, which was a civilian contract school for primary, flying a steerman. And then finished that program, sent to Marana Army Air Base, Arizona, about 25 miles north of Tucson, for basic. My class, 45B, was the first one to fly the AT-6 in basic. Class 45A was flying the BT-13. In basic flying school. Finished there, and I got assigned to twin engine flying at Marfa, Texas. in the Big Bend country, and graduated from Marfa, Texas, as a pilot and a second lieutenant on the 15th of April, 45.
Hmm. Now, let me back up here a little bit, if I may, Colonel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're there in California, and you're going through pre-flight. Now, you spend a very, very long and somewhat illustrious career in the Army Air Forces, or Army Air Corps, then Army Air Forces.
Army Air Corps, yeah.
And then later on, of course, when in the Air Force.
Yes.
Take me through the various levels of training. For example, start with pre-flight. What did pre-flight training consist of back then?
Well, pre-flight training consisted of a whole lot of marching. And ground school. Typically, we did ground school 4 to 6 hours a day. It would vary a little bit during the week of ground school, all having to do basically with flying, everything from the study of weather to the dynamics of air wing, I mean a wing and all that kind of stuff. Everything to do with an airplane. And then an awful lot of marching. After we'd been there a month, we were allowed to go on open house on Saturday night and Sunday, but you had to be back at the base at Santa Ana, which, by the way, nowadays is the Orange County Fairgrounds. Mm. Santa Ana was one of the largest bases during World War II that never had an airport.
Mm.
But anyway, we had to be back at 3 o'clock Sunday afternoon, and at 4 o'clock, everybody fell out for one big class march. There was 4,000 cadets, heavy cadets there, in various levels. I think we had about four classes at a time going through there. And then from there, the all ground school again went to up to. Don't blink here.
That's all right. You go from pre-flight. You're going to go to primary flight training.
Yeah, primary flight training.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
And what did the primary flight training consist?
Okay, primary flight training. We always had ground school, weather. excuse me. A lot of emphasis on weather training, and again on aerodynamics, everything associated with trying to fly an airplane, and. For ground school, and then we started flying right away. I think, if I recall, at Lancaster, by the way, a civilian contract school, and just north of Los Angeles, about 45 miles.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, ground school in the morning, when we'd fly in the afternoon, and Stearman, that was a biplane. The early training, of course, was just a learn how to get in and out of the airplane. And I had a civilian instructor that had literally hundreds and hundreds of hours. He was a great guy. I don't recall his name anymore. But fantastic guy. And he had four cadets assigned, and he'd fly two in the morning and two in the afternoon, and we went to ground school on the, if we weren't flying, we're going to ground school and vice versa. But he took us through the training, everything from basic being able to get the airplane off the ground and back on the ground. Then we had to go through our aerobatics, and then eventually we got soloed. I recall it was after about five or six flights we were allowed to solo, and then after that, half our training would be the instructor and the other half be practicing solo.
Mm-hmm.
We had four different areas. Lined out in the safe flying areas for the flying areas for one for acrobatics, another one for instrument training, because that was an instructor and that sort of thing, and but all about airplanes. I have one interesting sidelight while I was I was pretty close to departing primary flying school. But had a series of low cumulus clouds, post-frontal type situation, mm-hmm. where the little cumulus clouds, were not very thick and not very low, probably between 2,000 or 3,000 feet above the ground. So you're not supposed to fly above the clouds, of course. Well, I had to find out what it would be like if I did. So I climbed up on top of the clouds and was doing some turns and one thing or another up there. And so I'm flying along, and all of a sudden, on either side of me, two P-39s, I think they were P-39s or P-63s, one or the other, out of Muroc, now Edwards Air Force Base, Muroc in those days, Muroc Training Center. But these two guys, one on one side, one on the other, went by me upside down on both sides. And, of course, I saw that. I'm above the clouds, where I shouldn't be in the first place. And so I promptly saw that, so they must still be laughing till this day. But, of course, I turned the airplane over upside down real quick because I thought, boy, I was wrong side up when I saw these guys go by upside down. Well, need to say, I fell down through the clouds, and fortunately there was plenty of plenty of time to recover. And it was probably 40 years before I ever told that story to anybody. But anyway, that finished primary flying school. Then we moved to Tucson, or to Marana Army Air Base. And there we were flying AT-6s the first time. I remember looking in an AT-6 cockpit for the first time and said, my God, this is so complicated, I'll never figure it out. But we did. And again, the training with instructors, of course, about half the time for the first part of the program and basic flying training. And then a lot of solo work. Again, we had areas designated for everything from acrobatics to, again, instrument practice and that sort of thing. So formation flying. We took up formation flying there. Not as intense as it might have been, I guess, but the formation was a big deal for fighters if you went to fighter training. I don't recall exactly how I got selected for twin engine as opposed to fighters, but I was glad I did because I never cared much for acrobatic flying. So from there, then we finished that program and reported into Marfa, Texas, for advance with the AT-17 UC-78, known as the Bamboo Bomber.
Mm-hmm.
The twin-engine airplane, and again, the training was very similar there, again, with an instructor, then a lot of solo. Of course, it wasn't solo then. We always had when we flew an hour and a half or so training sortie, one of the cadets had flying in the left seat, and another cadet in the right seat, and then the next time we flew, we'd reverse. He'd be in the left seat, and I'd be in the right seat.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way we went through the training there. Again, a lot of formation flying, cross-country flying. The the AT-17 was a fixed-pitch prop airplane. The UC-78 had variable pitch. The AT-17, our minimum altitude on a cross-country from Marfa, Texas to El Paso to Salt Flats and back to Marfa, the minimum altitude between El Paso and Salt Flats was 10,000 feet, and you couldn't, and the AT-17 with those fixed pitch props couldn't get to 10,000 feet, so you always fudge a little bit, you know, about 9,000, that was about it. Anyway, cross country training and all that, and on 15 April 45, my folks, by the way, came down from Carlsbad, but this time they'd moved. In 1944, my dad and mom moved to Carlsbad, New Mexico. Because the farming in the late 44, the U.S. government decided to draft the wetbacks, as we called them in those days. I guess you can't do that nowadays, but anyway, threatened to draft them in the Army, and all of a sudden, Dad's got a problem trying to get his crops in. So they used a system of all the farmers up and down the Members River north of Deming, got the few U.S. citizens together. That's the way they harvested their crops in fall of 44. And so Dad and Mom, my dad's brother, worked at potash mines in Carlsbad. So he'd been after my dad to come over there and go work for years, and he finally did. Dad went to work at potash mines, and they lived in Carlsbad, New Mexico at that time. So on 15-45, they came down to my graduation exercise and becoming a second lieutenant and a pilot.
I bet they were—they must have been just really, really proud of you for going through all those accomplishments.
Well, my youngest sister, by the way, she was only between 2 and 3 at that point in time. And so, of course, we always had to wear uniforms in World War II. And when I came home on leave after the graduation for a few days, she hid because she didn't like my uniform.
Is that right?
I still tease her about that, by the way.
Now, here it is, April of 1945. Obviously, I'm sure you've been following the progress of the war in addition to your studies and in addition to your training. Mm-hmm. Did you know where you were slated to go? The war in Europe is winding down here by April of 1945. It won't be much longer before the war in Europe is over. Did you know, or did you have a preference on where you would go?
Well, actually, in those days, there wasn't such thing as a preference, really. Mm-hmm. Nobody asked you what you were going to do. Somebody told you.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, while I was still at Marfa, and just before graduation, in fact, I think it was about 2 weeks before graduation, assignments all came out. Well, 21 of my class, all second lieutenants, were selected to go to Central Instructor School, learn how to be an instructor, and then we were assigned to Luke Field at Phoenix as instructors.
Hmm.
Our job there, and that's where I went after I went to Central Instructor School, wound up at Luke. And our job there was to get the combat guys that were returning from Europe. Most of them were at least captains, quite a few majors, a few still first lieutenants. But we are second lieutenants, and we were added to the to a separate cadre. Our total job there was to keep the guys current that had been flying combat in Europe for the big push in Japan. Now, see, I arrived at Luke. I don't recall exact date, but somewhere around late June. And so immediately we're in the back seat of a T-6, and I've got a captain or a major in the front seat. And he flew the T-6 probably in advanced flying school before he went to the war in Europe. So he's trying to fly that T-6 like a P-51 or a P-47 or even a P-38. And here I am, a second lieutenant, scared to death at this guy that's senior to me. And that's how I learned to be a noisy guy, because it finally dawned on me those guys might kill me if I didn't make them shape up. So I learned how to be the instructor in charge. With that. But anyway, we would typically fly at Luke. We would typically fly two missions in the morning, or two flights in the morning, 1 hour each, and then two in the afternoon. And then as it got hotter, where you could fry an egg on the wing, we would fly one at usually at a 7:30 or 8 o'clock takeoff. Of course, I had a bunch of them. We had 85 T-6s there, so there'd be a whole bunch of us trying to fly at the same time. So we start about 7:30, again, an hour mission, finish that up, and then we knock off until about 4 in the afternoon, and we'd fly 2 in the afternoon. And we went through that whole thing all the way up until the A-bomb was dropped in Japan. But our job, and all that time, and like I said, I'm flying at least twice a day, usually as much as 4 times a day, with these guys, lieutenants, captains, and majors that had been in combat. We had 4,000 pilots assigned at Luke at that time. And so the 21 of us, and we were augmented finally with some other instructors to keep this thing going. Because all we knew at the time, and that's what our briefings consisted of, is the big push for Japan. And that's before any of us had ever thought about an atomic bomb.
Sure. Now, were you disappointed at all that you were relegated to instructor?
As a matter of fact, I really was. Mm-hmm. After talking to these guys that I was flying with and that sort of thing, the experience they had, I really felt shorted that I had not got a chance to get involved in combat.
Now, you're tasked with trying to keep these guys current in the AT-6, and they've been flying these other planes, and obviously, like you said, that would be quite difficult. They have all kinds of experience that you don't have, plus they outrank you. That certainly would have been a tricky situation to be in.
Well, it's kind of tricky, but our bosses took care of that. He warned all these experienced guys, you know, that's been in combat for some of them for a couple of years, that the guy in the back seat of that T-6 was in charge, and they should pay attention to that. Some of the things that was occurring at that point, like I say, they're trying to fly the airplane like a fighter, and of course T-6 didn't fly like a fighter. If you got the thing upside down and left it for a little bit, and the engine quit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, your fighter airplanes didn't do that. Anyway, so we had another situation that was bad at Luke Field. Our commanders were having meetings sometimes as many as 3 days a week in a theater for all the pilots. Anyway, what was happening was that we get these guys recurrent. I think, as I recall, we had to fly with them at least 5 times, I think it was, before we could turn them loose to go solo. And then they'd put 2 guys in the same T-6. They'd all gang up, decide on their own without proper briefing and so on, to go out and rat race over the Sierra Straw Mountains south of Phoenix, or south of Luke Field. And so in the month of August, I remember that distinctly, we lost 24 pilots of flying airplanes into the ground.
Huh.
Now, I don't recall whether any of them running each other or how it all happened, but we lost 24 pilots. That's when we were having meetings 2 or 3 times a week to, hey, wait a minute, we can't kill people off here, and we can't lose airplanes, all that kind of stuff. And even one commander got fired. I don't remember his name anymore. Got fired because of all those accidents and killing people. So, but anyway, I'm sorry. I said August, July, because the when the bomb was dropped, and of course that was the big news in Japan. You know, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
All of our flying stopped. We didn't fly then. Didn't fly, as I recall, for about 4 or 5 days while all that was going on, and end of the war, ultimately becoming the end of the war and so on. But
right.
In July, we lost all those pilots, so the training was fierce. I have no idea whether our commanders, the colonels and that sort of thing, had any idea what was going on with the B-29s at that point or not. I have no idea. If they did, then I never recall hearing anything about it.
Right. You mentioned the end of the war in Europe and, of course, the impending end of the war in Japan. What mm-hmm. do you remember about the war ending in Europe, VE Day?
Well, the only thing I recall about that especially, well, they formed a POW. We had POWs at Luke Field also that sort of changed things around on the ground there, so to speak, a huge POW camp on Luke. The only thing that meant to us really from what I was doing at that time was more pilots to keep current in the T-6 because mm-hmm. we had additional pilots come into Luke at that point for the big push in Japan. That was my only the only way it affected me. I knew the war was over and that was great, but all the briefings that we got and so forth for the build-up of the number of pilots would be needed for the big push in Japan. Mm-hmm.
Now, you say that there were a number of prisoners of war there at Luke. I would assume these would be primarily German POWs?
Well, yeah, we had a small group of Italians, but most of them were German.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any sort of interaction with them at all? Did you see them?
Yeah. Well, they a lot of them worked in the officers' club and mess hall and so forth. They worked there. I never had much contact with them, but... they were there. There were servers and worked in the chow lines at the club and the mess hall. That's the only place I ever saw them.
What was their attitude toward you, toward the United States, toward the war in general? Do you know?
I don't really know. Don't recall much of anything there. But I flew the Berlin Airlift later, and I'll tell you, all the Germans I ran across when I was doing the airlift thought we were absolutely fantastic. So I have no idea what the reaction of the prisoners, POWs were.
What about the attitude of the Americans toward the German and, to a lesser degree, the Italian POWs? What were
well,
the
they were still SOBs as far as the people I dealt with.
Hmm. All right. Now, in August of 1945, obviously, the big news is the U.S. dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima mm-hmm. and a few days later on Nagasaki.
Uh-huh.
You mentioned that, yes, it stopped your flying for a while there while people were trying to sort all this out. Yeah. What did you think about that? I mean, what was your reaction to the news that the U.S. had used this this unprecedented weapon?
So many people around me, this includes the senior guys I was flying with, the returnees from combat and so on, as well as some of my compatriots, or my contemporaries, rather, where they were flying with us. So many of them were saying, hey, the war's over. I'm going to get out and go back to the farm or whatever. And that was the tone of the majority of the guys I knew. I never thought about it that way. I could have always gone back to work with Dad, I think, but I never really thought about it that way. The military had got to be real interesting for me. And I didn't make a conscious decision at that point, or even knew whether I could stay in the military or not. But I was enjoying the military life. I really was.
Interesting.
Especially flying the airplanes.
Right, right. What was the reaction of the folks there at Luke when the news came there in early September when the Japanese finally officially surrendered? What was the atmosphere like there? What was the environment there like?
Idea of getting out of the army was sole thought of many of the people I was associated with.
Yeah, and obviously it wasn't your train of thought. You enjoyed the military.
I don't think I really made much of an issue of that with my buddies, but my thoughts were I was enjoying the military.
Mm-hmm. Now, was there any sort of I won't say fear, but trepidation that the army may say, okay, we're done with you, Austin. We don't need you anymore.
Well, yes, it was. It looked like that was going to happen. As a matter of fact, we had, I recall one big briefing, probably more than that, but one in particular, where all of us more junior guys had been called into the base theater. And I guess, well, part of it was to try to clarify the rumors, I guess, about what was going to happen, as the war was over. This actually was going on for a couple of weeks right after the bomb was dropped, and then when the Japanese signed off, we had another meeting, as I recall, mostly our junior types, and again trying to explain to us what was going to happen. And the general theme was that we'll line you up and count you off and discharge you and let you go back home.
Now, what happened in your particular case?
Well, in my case, I asked if I could stay at Luke Field, and everything was done manually in those days. It's hard for me to recall some of the things, but I know your military records are always getting screwed up because everything was done manually, and you never saw the same person twice. You went to personnel and that sort of thing. So I remember volunteering to stay there, and I had to go through personnel to tell them that's personnel office, and I met I saw a lady there, and I said I wanted to stay. She said, well, okay, then you come back here. I don't know, 2 or 3 days later, what it was, and so I went on doing my business and. Come back whenever the appointed time was coming back. And of course that lady was, I didn't see her again, and they're trying to go through the files and see what I was doing and so forth, and they assumed everybody wanted to get out of the service. And I told a guy this time, I said, no, I don't want to get out of the service, I want to stay here. Well, okay. That went on and off for a couple of three different appointments. And then finally, there was several of us that was retained there, and so we went back to a proficiency, maintaining proficiency in flying program. Instead of flying, each of us flying an individual airplane, most of the time we're two of us in the same airplane, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But we really were not working very hard at all. We were allowed to fly every other day at the most, and then later it was only twice a week. So it ground down that way.
Mm-hmm.
And it went that way really for about 2 months. Then I got transferred to just me, and I never could figure out why just me. But I got transferred up to Seattle to oh, what the heck's the name of the fort up there?
Lewis, probably.
No, there's a fort up there where I'm still a second lieutenant, of course, and I was sent up there to help processing the replacement guys for overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Replacement guys in the Far East, and so the guys could come back home. So this was in January. I got up there in November, as I recall, of 45, and we're moving people through, I can't remember the name of that fort up there. Anyway, it was a POE, a port of embarkation, and our job was, working for a captain, and there was about three of us lieutenants, and our job was processing these guys and checking their, making sure they checked their records and paying them. I remember sitting at the pay table, seemed like at least once a week, sometimes twice a week, with the 45 laying on the table and paying these guys in cash, that sort of thing, and the ones that were going to go to being transferred to Japan, to the Far East, I should say. And so I was there for about 3 months, end of January, something like that, of 46. And they were starting a reserve training program at Boeing Field with AT-6s.
Mm-hmm.
And so they moved me, I volunteered to transfer down there, and sure enough, they let me do it to help get the reserve training program going with AT-6s at Boeing Field.
And what would your duties there consist of?
I'm sorry?
What would your duties there consist of?
I'm sorry, Kelly.
I'm sorry, Colonel. What were you be doing there?
Flying.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. I guess put it out in the paper, and other guys that had been in the military and so forth, getting a reserve program. So they had a lieutenant colonel there, set in charge of setting up the reserve program. And so these guys that had been in the military are coming in, pilots, had been in the military and had got out and decided they wanted to stay in the reserves. And so my job only was just to get these guys recurrent to T-6.
Hmm. Okay. Now, how long were you there?
I was only there about three more months, and by April of 46, I was back at Luke Field.
Mm-hmm. Now, why were you sent back down to Luke?
I requested to go back to Luke as an instructor, and they sent me back there. I wasn't there. I was back at Luke not very long, and I went to signed up to go to communications school at Scott Field, Illinois. So I transferred to Scott Field. Remember, everything was done manually in those days.
Right.
I don't remember the details anymore, but I know that we'd wait for processing and everything was done manually, and invariably they couldn't find your records when you went to personnel and all those kind of things. Anyway, I went to Scott Field then as going to communications school.
Now, why did you choose communications?
I'm sorry?
Why did you choose communications?
Say one more time, Kelly. I hate to ask you over.
No, that's no problem. Why did you want to go into communications? I mean, you
well,
were a successful pilot.
I needed to do something else. The word was out that you just can't just be a pilot. You've got to do something else.
Okay.
So get another MOS, Military Operational Specialty.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sounded interesting. So besides, I've never been to Illinois, so I thought that'd be interesting to go to school back to Scott Field. I knew Scott Field was an old base. And so I signed up for that because everybody, all the pilots were told, you got to find something else besides just being a pilot.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, tell me about your time there at Luke. Or, I'm sorry, at Scott.
I'm sorry?
Tell me about your time there at Scott.
Oh, at Scott. Okay. Well, I got to Scott, and we started regular ground school, communication school. And, of course, having been an instructor pilot in the T-6 and so forth, they had T-6s there, so immediately, my extra duty was to be an instructor pilot for, at Luke for, back in those days also, Kelly, I guess to lift this out, And in those days, and for several years after World War II, you had to fly 4 hours a month during the month in order to get flying pay. Mm-hmm. Well, flight pay was significant in those days. I drew $126 a month as a second lieutenant, but I drew 50% more of that for flying. So that was $60 more is a whole lot of money in those days.
Sure.
So everybody had to get 4 hours a month, and that was always the some way to get everybody 4 hours a month was a was a big deal. And so guys had to stay current in an airplane, or a guy like me had to fly with a guy like me to get their 4 hours. So that's why it was so important for the administrative airplanes. Well, AT-6s were administrative airplanes in those days. I got checked out in a C-47 while I was there. We had a lot of those signed there also. And then the, I don't recall the exact date, but the Texas City disaster, have you ever run across that at, at Galveston?
Yes.
Well, I was going to school, and I'd been flying at, when I wasn't in school, and usually after school in the afternoon and so forth, when I'd fly an hour or so on a T-6, either with somebody or maybe just solo. And so I was invited to fly co-pilot C-47, so I'd done that a couple of times. And then when the Texas City disaster happened, they asked for, you know, St. Louis was one of the primary centers for the Red Cross. So they asked Scott Field to try to haul a lot of the Red Cross people down to Galveston or San Antonio and then Galveston, as the case may be. That's what we wound up doing. So anyway, I got tapped, and I said, wait a minute, I'm going to school. He says, that's okay. We'll take care of that later. So I was in a co-pilot seat in the C-47 the evening after that occurred the night before, and en route to San Antonio, and we had some Red Cross people on board and a whole lot of supply, Red Cross-type supplies and so forth for down here. And wound up the guy I was flying with, we wound up to stay down there and haul stuff. The 4th Army, General Stilwell was the commander of 4th Army at San Antonio. And so we're under his command to move stuff back and forth to Galveston for the Texas City disaster. So we were down there, I wound up been down there about 6 weeks altogether, and I slept back two classes in the communications school in the process. We made at least two or three trips a day between San Antonio with hauling supplies or people to Galveston and back. One interesting morning, by the way, the first pilot that I was with had a son that had some physical problems. I don't recall what they were anymore, but they're very serious. And so his wife had called him and wanted to come back to Scott Field. So he had called back, and we'd been down there about 3 or 4 weeks at the time, by that time. And so he asked to go back to Scott Field, and the guy said, well, we don't have another pilot to replace you with. He said, yes, we do. He said, Hal Austin is checked out. I looked at him when he said that, and I said, I am. He said, you will be. Tell me to get back to Scott. So he'd been instructing to C-47 for a long time. So anyway, we flew back to Scott that night. So he could get out. I was assigned a second lieutenant as a co-pilot. And the next morning, after a little crew rest, went back to San Antonio again. So anyway, I flew several trips with my new co-pilot. Every morning we'd had to be out there by 8 o'clock in the morning. And sometimes the airplane would be loaded, sometimes it would not. And anyway, we'd show up out there on the flight line, ready to go. And this one morning, we looked in the airplane, got out the flight line, pre-flighted it, and looked in the airplane, and no load, no people. And so we had a guy that ran up down the flight line, a major that was would tell us what our load was and so forth. So I waved him down. I said, hey, what are we doing today? He said, you just stand by. Okay, so we stood by, and about a half hour or so later, here comes a staff car down with the flags waving on the bumper, I'm on the fender, and that sort of thing, and all of a sudden it kept a little bit closer to the airplane, and I see a four-star, red four-star flag.
Hmm.
Well, General Stilwell gets out of that car, comes over with his aide, and comes over and shakes my hand. Of course, my co-pilot and I are shaking at our booths. I've never been that close to a four-star before. And he shook her hand, you know, we saluted. He shook her hands and said, would you guys take me to Galveston? Yes, sir. So we got the airplane and cranked it up. He sat in a jump seat between the two pilots. One of the most friendliest guys I've ever been around in my life. Of course, I'm scared to death all this time, afraid I'm going to do something wrong. But we flew him to Galveston. We got down on the ground in Galveston, you know, and he and his aide, and he says, have you been to Texas City yet to see all the, what's going on there and so forth? No, sir. Come with me. So we got out of our airplane and told the guy checking us on the ground, always there checking us on the ground, you know, said General Sullivan invited us to go with him to the Texas City, and so we'll be back later on. So we got in his Jeep, and he gave us a personal tour. He'd been there before, of Texas City, the most interesting day I'd ever had in my life. So anyway, we saw some of the things in the big buildings there where they were still, I don't remember how many days this was after the disaster, quite a while, but still a lot of people being cared for, and makeshift place in the high school there and so on. Anyway, so after a while he says, well, I appreciate you guys bringing me down here. We'll see you later. And so he told his driver to take us back to the airport. So that was a highlight of my there. And then we stayed there for about another 3 weeks, a total of about 6 weeks from Scott Field before we finally wrapped up and went back. So that was my experience with the Texas City disaster.
Well, let me ask you about that just briefly, Colonel. Texas City disaster was, of course, this huge industrial accident, massive explosion, tremendous damage, hundreds of people killed.
It sure was, yeah.
What did Texas City look like as you were taking this tour, as it were?
Well, they still hadn't done a lot around where that ship was, and the damage, you know, the you could see where that explosion had occurred when that ship blew up. And I'll tell you, just after the devastating, I'd never seen a war-torn area before, but that's the first thing, except in pictures. Mm-hmm. And that's the first thing I said, boy, this is, that's what this is like, I guess.
Hmm.
So, you know, you just wonder, we hadn't heard anything about why and so forth, except that we heard it was an accident, I guess it was, but the reasons why and or what caused it and that sort of thing, that word was out, it hadn't got to guys like me yet.
Right, right. Huh, interesting. All right, now you wind up back in Scott Field again, is that correct, after this?
Well, we went back and finished communication school, and then I got transferred to McCord Field, flying C-82s. I was now a communications officer, so I was assigned to base communications at McCord. When I got up there, and they were getting brand new C-82s, the forerunner of C-119, and of course they found out that they knew I was a pilot as well. So I subsequently was assigned to one of the C-82 squadrons as the squadron communications officer, and of course I started out as a co-pilot in the C-82. We were getting those airplanes out of Hagerstown, Maryland. So initially, I was a co-pilot. Our basic mission there was, other than training and getting acquainted with the C-82, was hauling the Army guys at Fort what's the base there next to McCord? Old age is catching up with me, kid.
That's all right.
Anyway, we're hauling people to Alaska and swapping out Alaska training with the Army.
Mm-hmm.
We had just the C-82 was a twin-engine airplane. They would not let us fly up the coast, so we had to fly from McCord to Great Falls and land there. Then go the Canadian route. Typically we stopped at Fort Nelson for gas in Canada, and then on up either to Mile 26, it was called in those days. It's now Allison Air Force Base. It was called Mile 26, then 26 miles from Ladd Field. And so we go in there or into Ladd Field, occasionally down to Elmendorf, but usually it was at Ladd Field or Mile 26. We drop our guys off, spend the night and reverse track, and haul another batch that had been up there in training back to Fort Nelson, Great Falls, and back to McCord. That was our job. I don't know how many of those trips I made. The C-82 was the first airplane that had been built with hot wings.
Explain that to me.
Hot wings for de-icing.
Mm-hmm.
So the C-54s had been used before that, and the C-47s had boots. And some of that severe icing, real bad icing in the wintertime, they'd ground them because the boots just wouldn't take care of it. On the wing boots would not take care of de-icing. So as a result, that C-82 with the hot wings was no problem with the de-icing. So we flew through I learned a lot about flying weather, through weather and so forth there that the previous C-47 and C-54 couldn't fly through. But our hot wings, we could. And so we just kept on operating no matter what the weather was like. So I spent time there, and then in November of 48, I'd been there for, a year and a half. Oh, well, by the way, also we went to Pope Field, North Carolina, with our C-82s, and dropping troops. I was a troop carrier outfit. The C-82 was a troop carrier outfit. And so we'd go down to Pope Field and drop troops down there on temporary duty. We usually get down there a month at a time, and then go back to McCord and back to moving the Army guys to Alaska. So in November of 48, I got my October of 48, I got my orders to go to Japan. I had not been overseas, so it was about time I was sent overseas.
Mm-hmm. Now, what would be the nature of your assignment in Japan?
As a pilot in communications.
Mm-hmm.
Communications squadron officer, probably that sort of thing. But it was a combination. But I never went to Japan.
Mm.
Because we went through, the POE at that time was Hamlin Field, California. So that's where I reported to. And I still had my car, by the way, and that became important later on. But reported at Hamlin Field, and anyone that was at least 1,200 hours flying time, pilots, were going to be turned around to go to fly the airlift. Because the airlift had got started in that summer, and the MATS guys, military airlift, called MATS in those days, with their C-54s, had been sent temporary duty typically for 30 days to Germany to start the airlift, and here was, most of them been over a lot longer than 30 days, so they started a transition program at Great Falls, Montana, with C-54s and MATS instructors, and so anyone with 1,200 hours flying time that was en route to Japan or wherever was going to be turned around to go to the airlift. Well, we spent about 3 weeks checking in every day at Hamlin Field, and by the way, I stayed in the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. Had a deal for us guy in the military. For $1 a day, we could stay in the Sir Francis Drake Hotel.
Hmm. Wow.
So needless to say, we didn't stay in the BOQ. We stayed in the Sir Francis Drake Hotel. They were very friendly there. Anyway, I met up a couple other guys in the same boat I was in. We're en route to Japan. They're being turned around for the airlift. So we got to be buddies there, you know, and so forth during that 2 or 3 week period. And then we knew we were going to go to Great Falls to go through C-54 transition, because the other two guys and I, none of us had ever, we'd seen the C-54, that's about it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, after about 3 weeks, we drove to and stopped at Reno and spent a little time in Reno first, but we drove on up to Great Falls, Montana, and the BOQs or tar paper shacks that they were getting refurbished and so forth. They'd been closed down, you know, after World War II. And so anyway, somebody decided they were not adequate quarters for officers, so we stayed in a hotel in downtown Great Falls for that training. Anyway, we went through the training program, earned C-54, a great airplane. And after finishing that training, and so forth, went through Westover, and then commercial Alaska Airlines commercial C-54 delivered us to Germany. I arrived in Germany on Thanksgiving Day of 48. And we got on the ground there, and the report was, is, okay, you're going to the place called the Betz area in Frankfurt for as a BOQ, and we want you back here in 12 hours for your first flight to Berlin.
Now, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, the Berlin blockade and
airlift.
Well, was...
flying airplanes. Mm-hmm. Always flying airplanes was always uppermost in my mind. And I liked that C-54. It's a good airplane. Yeah, I've never flown a four-engine airplane before, of course, even close to it. So, anyway, we got back out there, and the guys assigned to fly with was a captain, and found that he'd been he'd come over originally from Westover as one of the MATS guys for 30 days, and he'd been there 3 months already, and his wife was expecting a baby.
Hmm.
So that all became first clear on their first flight. Anyway, typically out of Station Rhein Main, by the way, in Frankfurt.
Okay.
And we would typically there fly two trips to Berlin and back, and then be off 12 hours and then go back and do it again. And depending on how the weather was, how the flight stream went back and forth, that typically the two trips could take as little as 9 or 10 hours, and usually around 12 hours or so to complete those two trips. And so anyway, I flew a co-pilot on the first trip, and the next trip up, no, I flew co-pilot both trips. And we're off 12 hours, we're back out there to do it again, and this time I'm in the left seat, and he's in the right seat, he's an instructor, of course. We flew two trips that day, and after the second trip, he says, let's go and operate. Normally, we'd have a catch a bus and go back to the Betz area. And I said, let's go and see the ops officer, and so we did. He said, Austin's checked out. Normally, we had to have six flights to and from Berlin. And again, I'm shaking my head. What do you mean I'm checked out? He says, yeah, I am. He says, I'm going home. My wife's expecting a baby. ops officer, well, he knew the guy was expecting a baby, you know, all along.
Right.
Those are the kind of things that sometimes they pay attention to. Anyway, where it turns out, sure enough, I was checked out. He wrote me off as a first pilot. And as far as I know, he left the next day going back to the States. So I flew 156 missions totally from the beginning on the day after Thanksgiving of 48 until I left Germany in August of 49. And the another significant occurrence there is early January. I bought a little Italian Fiat off a crew chief. Bought it. He had to go back to stay emergency reason back to the States or something. I'd bought that little Italian Fiat, and anyway, my buddy and I, he'd met one of the girls over there, and says I want you to go meet my girlfriend. I'll borrow your car, and I said no, you won't. I'll drive you over there. So. To make things a little more complicated, it's early January, and I don't know whether it's this sort of thing or not, but
sure.
It's all part of military life. Anyway, we got back one of our trips to Berlin, and our 200-hour inspection was in Burtonwood, England. So we'd fly the 54s over to Burtonwood, and we'd take one over for do a 200-hour inspection and pick up one that was completed and bring it back. Well, we finished our second trip, and the ops officer, the line ops officer says, hey, this airplane's got to go to Burtonwood. And I said, I just finished two trips. Well, he said, you haven't been flying that long today, so take this airplane to Burtonwood. So I did. And we got another airplane to pick up back. And so in the meantime, this stretched into about a 15, 16-hour day. But we got back from that trip to Burtonwood late afternoon. So my buddy, he's flying his co-pilot for me at that point in time. So I'm going to go see my girlfriend. So I drove over there with him and went into her apartment. She had a couch there, and I said, I said, nice to meet you and all that kind of stuff. I'm going to lay down on the couch and rest. So I did and put my hat over my eyes, and pretty soon my buddy shook my toe and said, I want you to meet somebody. And I raised my hat up and said hi, and it was Rosemary. Her name was Rosemary. And I put my hat back down on my eyes and went back to sleep. And so later on, going back to the vets area, our BOQs, I said, hey, that was a pretty good-looking gal. I'd like to, how can I get a hold of her? So anyway, make a very long story short, I married that gal in July of 49.
Is that right?
And we were married 61 years until I lost her in July of 2010.
Hmm. I'm sorry to hear that. This is a terrific story, though. Just amazing.
Well, interesting story. By the way, they didn't have any procedures for Americans marrying Americans. Mm-hmm. By the way, she'd graduated from high school in at Columbus, Ohio, at St. Mary's of the Spring Catholic School, boarding school. And joined her stepdad was in the U.S. Army as a warrant officer, and her mother had joined him in Germany sometime in 47. And she graduated from high school in 47 and joined them over there after that. So, and I met her then in January of 49. And like I say, after rapid courtship and so forth, I even took her very illegally. Took her twice to Berlin, and during the night, one time with her girlfriend, and I. She always told the emergency procedures a lot better than I can, but she always used to tell everybody, "Yeah, he took me along." And his instructions to me were, "If anything happens to this airplane, you crawl as far away from it as you can, because otherwise I'll be court-martialed." Well, hell, I'd have been court-martialed anyway if he even knew she was on board.
I would think so. Yes.
But anyway, that was an interesting sidelight, and my kids tease me all the time is that's why their mother married me, because I threatened her by kicking her out of an airplane at altitude.
Well, let me take you back here a little bit, Colonel. The Berlin airlift, of course, was this, a monumental historical moment, mm-hmm. if you will.
Yep.
Now, there you are in the western part of Germany, and you're ferrying these goods over to Berlin.
Mostly coal and flour.
Okay. Tell me about the entire process of, the pace of missions you've already talked about, but take me through showing up there on the flight line, getting your orders, you're flying over in some sort of formation. Take me through the route. Take me through the entire process of being part of the Berlin airlift. This is fascinating.
No formation. The interesting, very interesting flying, and of course we get over there in the wintertime, and the snowflakes in Germany are the biggest snowflakes I've ever seen. One of them just about covered the windshield in a C-54. But be that, that's a side issue. Anyway, we flew in line, no formation
okay.
flying. But we had excellent maintenance. Those airplanes were maintained, the ability to fly them and haul. They were C-54 designed for 10,000 pounds of whatever. We've hauled 20,000 pounds of coal, flour. The flour, by the way, all in sacks. The coal was in tow sacks. I would guess those sacks weighed about 80 pounds each.
Mm-hmm.
The Germans, of course, were doing the loading and unloading, and I tell you, those guys throw those sacks around like they were weighed 15 pounds. I tell you, they were really impressed with how their work ethic. All the Germans that I got come into contact with, their work ethic was fantastic. They were all very friendly. No animosity at all. They were all very pleased that the United States was doing this for them.
Mm-hmm.
But we hit the flight line, pre-flight the airplane, and it'd be all ready to be loaded. We'd check the load, tie down, all that kind of stuff, the normal pre-flight procedures. Jump in, go, and then taxi out and get in line for takeoff. There's always a line for takeoff. And the interval we were flying between airplanes on takeoff would vary a little bit based on the weather. But typically, we'd be in a 5 to 7 minute. In other words, we'd launch 5 to 7 minutes behind the guy that took off in front of us,
mm-hmm.
and you would maintain that position carefully all the way to Berlin. We had a radio checkpoint, Fulda, that was about 10 minutes from after takeoff, 10-15 minutes after takeoff. Then you hit the corridor from Fulda. We had a 20-mile wide corridor going to Berlin, and we'd hit Berlin radio, and we were flying into Tempelhof out of Rhein Main, except when the weather got really awful. And so it was. We flew. We flew controlled airspeed. We fly 140 miles an hour indicated airspeed in that C-54 going up, and 150 miles an hour coming back. And because we're empty coming back, and you checked made your radio calls over Fulda, and you wanted to be exactly where you said you were, because you wanted the guy in front of you to be exactly where you said he was at that time, and you wanted to be sure the guy behind you respected you being there. So there wasn't any question about you being precise on the timing over a radio fix, and if you were off one way or the other, you made sure everybody knew that. And because you're flying in the weather. The same with checking over Berlin radio. Then you had a letdown procedure to come around and land, and you're trying to maintain the whatever that interval was. On real good weather days, which really didn't occur for us till about March of 49, we'd get the interval down as low as 3 minutes between airplanes and have the line full. And, of course, there's two other bases up north doing the same thing, but they were going into two different bases. So Ryan Main, all of our planes went into Tempelhof, unless the weather got real bad, and then we'd be transferred. So that was a normal procedure. Become very important to be to report where you were at the exact time, because you wanted to trust that guy in front of you and the guy behind you, because the guy behind you wanted to trust you. So that was precision flying and the best training, flying training I ever had in my whole life. Weather, lots of weather in the winter of 48, 49 and going to Berlin. I had 300 landings. If the weather got down too low, going into Tempelhof, we'd be waved off there. Of course, they'd stop the line or expand the line considerably, or even stop it. Weather got too bad, they'd stop the line, and no more takeoffs from Ryan Main. But it took a while to make that occur. So those of us that got airborne, we'd go ahead. You're allowed to make one pass at Tempelhof, and if you didn't break out by the time you hit, we had those apartment houses are on either side, so if you didn't break out by about 500 feet, they'd send you over to Gatow. That was the in the British sector. And our first experience with ground controlled approach, the British had developed that. So they would steer you over there. You're allowed one pass at Gatow, and if you didn't make it, you went back to Ryan Main, loaded. So the GCA ground control approach guys, the British guys, were absolutely fantastic. They bring you in over the outer fix and so forth, and start talking you down. Whether you're ready with ground control approach, I'm sure a lot of guys have talked to you about that. But they would talk you down in the weather, and we got our cards punched for a 0-0 landing. It means zero ceiling and zero visibility. And as always in snow, by the way, all three of them, heavy snow, and like I say, one snowflake in Germany would cover the whole windshield of a C-54. And but easy back, they knew the speeds of the C-54, very similar to the Lancasters that the British guys were flying in here.
Okay.
And they tell you when to ease off, ease the stick back, ease the power off, ease the stick back, ease the power off. And about that time you touch down, and you couldn't even see the ground in front of you. So there's always a Jeep out there with a big follow me that would pick you up there, and you'd follow him into parking. But that was a real thrill. That was a thrill.
Sure. Now, what would be the procedure once you hit the ground?
Once you hit the ground, we'd pull up, the trucks would back up that airplane, and the Germans at the end there would be unloaded. Now, for the May Day parade, Soviets made a big deal out of May Day.
Sure.
So for that May Day, I beg your pardon, the Easter parade first, then the May Day paper did it again. The weather was good, and so they started trying to find out how quick they could load an airplane and how quick they could unload it. So my first trip on the Easter parade, first trip to Berlin, they had that parked, shut all four engines down, and they unloaded that airplane in about 10 minutes. It was unloaded. And they told us not to get off the airplane. And we're starting number three, and to taxi on out. Well, by the time I made the third trip that day, they unloaded 20,000 pounds of, and hauled all coal, by the way. That's the quickest thing to handle. All coal. They unloaded my airplane in 8 minutes. By that time, we were not shutting down number 3 and 4 engine. We left those running. Hmm. And on that side, 8 minutes, they got that airplane empty, and we're starting 2 and 1 and taxiing out. The most fantastic operation you ever saw in your life to be a part of.
20,000 pounds of coal unloaded from a C-54 in 8 minutes.
I'm sorry?
I said that was 20,000 pounds of coal unloaded from
20,000 pounds, yeah. Where they were designed for 10, but we're flying 20. Well, we, you know, we're not fully loaded with fuel because we're it's an hour and a half up and an hour and 40 minutes up and an hour and 30 minutes back.
Mm-hmm.
So the flight was not very long.
Right.
And we're only, I forget the amount of gas we're carrying, but we're carrying just a third of a full of fuel. So it wasn't really... we're probably 5,000 pounds over what the airplane was designed for.
Mm-hmm. Now, tell me about the crew. Who was on the plane with you? How many crew members did you
have? Well, to start with, we always had a crew chief for an enlisted man that flew with us all the time. Then they became kind of scarce, so after I'd been there a couple of months, we did not have a aircraft flight engineers.
Hmm.
We didn't have enough flight engineers to go around, so normally just 2 pilots.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I had Darrell Lamb was wound up being my permanent co-pilot. He was a great guy, big guy, a great guy, but he couldn't fly airplanes for Shire Apple. So how he got through the pilot training program and all that kind of stuff, nobody could figure out. But he was a great guy, and he's a co-pilot, good co-pilot. So it was not unusual. I wasn't the only one that had a permanent co-pilot assigned. But for the last 4 months I flew over there, he was my co-pilot all the time. So we got along well. One other incident, and then I need to knock this one off, Kelly, and we'll pick it up again later sometime. But one more incident. We're flying, the weather is pretty good, and, of course, our 12 hours would be around the clock. You never knew whether you were going to be taking off at night, morning, evening, whatever. Well, old Darrell Lamb knew this one night. The weather was good, by the way, all over that area. Well, one night we were taking off on our second trip, probably 11 o'clock or midnight at night. You know, we'd already been up on one trip, and so this is our second trip. Well, on the second trip sometime in the middle of the night like that, well, we'd swap off. He'd take a nap going up, and I'd stay awake, and then the next time it'd be my turn to take a nap. And so anyway, this was my turn to take a nap. So we checked in over Fulda, and then we got just about an hour before we land. So time for a little nap. So I leaned my head over against the side of the airplane here and taking a little nap, you know. And so after a while, I woke up. Looked over, and old Darrell Lamb is leaning against the other side, sound asleep.
Oh, no.
So I looked out the windscreen, and it's dark as hell out there. There's no lights, by the way, in East Germany in those days. And it's dark as a son of a gun, so I shook Lamb real quick and says, "Wake up! Where the hell are we?" And so I decided to turn the air, take a 180-degree turn, and I could see Berlin lights. So it turns out we had flown at least 25 or 30 minutes over East Berlin.
Oh, no.
Now, in the daytime, of course, by the way, the Soviet fighters didn't fly at night. They only flew in the daytime, so we didn't have to worry about the fighters. They'd come check us once in a while during the daytime, but never at night. So anyway, I turned around and said, "Oh, shit, we're in deep trouble here." So I flew going back towards Berlin. I knew we were at least 25 or 30 minutes away, so I kept listening for the tail number of the airplanes reporting in over Berlin radio, and I was trying to figure out some way to work my way in to be sure that, I think the interval was probably running 7 minutes or something like that,
mm-hmm.
And so we didn't always run at 3 minutes. Most of the time it's 5 to 7 minutes between airplanes. So I heard a gap. A little bit on that. So anyway, I finally picked a point, and the weather was good. You could see everywhere at night. So I picked a point finally to turn over Berlin radio and report on Berlin radio. Got the usual response, okay, and made my approach, landed, unloaded, and worried to death all the way back to Rhine, Maine, that we're going to get caught for being out of the line for probably 45 or 50 minutes. Nobody ever said a word about that. So that tells you how much everybody else was sleeping too in the middle of the night. So we got away with it. Darrell Lamb and I sweated blood for a month after that. Figured somebody's going to catch up with us.
Well, let me ask you this before I let you go for today. Now, this is a highly coordinated effort. Weren't there planes who were supposed to be following you?
Well, nobody's paying attention. You didn't write down the three-digit tail number that was in front of you, or the one behind you, either one. It just got to be kind of automatic.
Mm-hmm.
You just heard somebody reporting in whatever their time was or whatever radio fix it was, and you waited for your time and double-checked that you were 7 minutes or whatever the interval was for that day, and just maintained that, obviously, if anybody noticed it, including the radio operators on the ground, they never said anything about it because he and I sweated blood for a month.
So they just
somebody's going to call us on it.
They in essence forgot that you were coming in because you weren't because of the
yeah, this is a side issue. There's a number of things I did over the years, Kelly. Anybody that flies an airplane and hadn't done stupid things flying airplanes. If they don't admit doing stupid things, they're lying.
That's terrific.
The best part of that is if you survive, and I was lucky enough to survive all those stupid things I did.
Well, let's go ahead and stop there for today, Colonel.
Yeah.
This is Kelly Krager, continuing an oral history interview with Colonel Hal Austin. Today is 20 September 2012. I am in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Colonel Austin is joining me by telephone from his home in California. Well, Colonel, we finished up your time with the Berlin Airlift the last time that we spoke, so let's pick up with your assignment following your time there flying the supplies into Berlin.
Okay, my assignment from Rhine Main Air Base in Frankfurt, Germany, said I was going to Barksdale Air Force Base and SAC, S-A-C. And at the time, I didn't know what SAC stood for because I thought Barksdale was a training command base, which it had been for years. Well, I reported in late August of 49 and to SAC and found out that stood for the Strategic Air Command. And I thoroughly understood it 28 years later when I had spent 25 of the 28 years in the Strategic Air Command. So, anyway. So I was assigned to Barksdale, initially to fly B-29s. SAC was, took over the base to expand the Strategic Air Command as a result of the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the Berlin Airlift was a large part of the early part of the Cold War. And it extended, so the SAC buildup was in progress. I assigned the 91st Strat Recon Wing at Strategic Reconnaissance Wing at Barksdale. They had B-17s, B-29s, two different versions of B-29s, electronic countermeasures airplanes, and also visual photo airplanes. And then while we were there, they got a squadron of B-50s in. So it's quite a varied organization. I was sent to B-29 Transition School at MacDill, Florida, and then was not assigned to a crew, although I was supposed to be, but instead assigned to wing operations. And of course, I was a first lieutenant at this point in time. I was assigned to base wing operations, which controlled, we set up schedules for airplanes and that sort of thing. I did do a lot of flying the B-29, however, as a substitute aircraft commander. Late 1950, we found out that the 91st Strat Recon Wing was going to get the RB-45C, their first the B-45 was the first four-engine jet bomber that the United States built after World War II. And the RB-45C was the visual photo reconnaissance version of that. There, because the economy, I should say, the buy of the RB-45C was cut to 33 airplanes. The original buy, I think, was for 100. I don't recall exactly, but there'd already been already built 100 of the A model B-45s, which were the bomber version, and that outfit actually was assigned by this by 1949 and 50 was assigned to Langley Field in Virginia. So SAC took the RB-45C. General LeMay, especially feeling very strongly about reconnaissance, post-strike reconnaissance, and so forth, because all this preparation was for the potential World War III. So we got the 45s, and I asked my boss if I could transition to the 45s instead of out of the 29s, and he gave me the okay. So I was one of nine pilots that were allowed to go out of the B-29s into the B-45s. I'm not sure how come just nine of us got selected, but that's the way it was. I was one of nine. So we, late 1950, they wanted to use the RB-45C in the Korean War. So the first three photo airplanes, the RB-45C that we got, they brought three senior crews from Langley, bomber crews, and our reconnaissance guys, photo crews, checked them out in how to do a visual photo. Because they've been flying the B-45A, and so the C wasn't that much different, bigger engines and some other changes, more fuel and that sort of thing. But anyway, so they checked out those. I was not involved in that, but they checked out the three crews, and the first three RB-45Cs were sent to Japan and were used. Three airplanes remained there until the armistice in 53. The crews, I didn't go over there, but I checked out some of the crews that did. They were taking photos, of course, of parts of China, parts of the Soviet Union, and a lot of North Korea, of course, at high altitude, better than the RB-29. So I stayed at Barksdale, of course. We got the next airplanes, we finally went up with a total of only 28 airplanes. The other test airplanes, the three in Korea and so forth, but the wing wound up with only 28 airplanes. And we had three squadrons, 322nd, 23rd, and 24th. I was in the 324 squadron. And we transitioned into the B-45, and then in early 51, we started doing temporary duty in England. As a part of the emergency war order set up, so the 322nd Squadron went in early 51 to Sculthorpe in the UK on TDY, our temporary duty, with a war plan. I'm not sure where all the targets were at the time. Maybe post-strike photography as a part of the emergency war order is what they were assigned to do. So later on in March 51, we replaced that squadron with the 324 squadron I was in, and we took eight airplanes, RB-45Cs over, and an equal number of KB-29s. The RB-45C refueled with a boom, first major airplane to use the boom air refueling, and we're using modified KB-29s, World War II airplanes, as tankers. So we had eight KB-29s and eight RB-45Cs at Sculthorpe in the UK. So in the meantime, before we actually left Barksdale for the UK, my squadron, we found out that the 91st was going to move to Lockburn Air Force Base, Ohio. It had been reopened. It had shut down temporarily. It had been reopened as an expansion also of SAC. And there was going to eventually be two wings at Lockburn. My squadron spent 3 months in the UK flying missions over Europe. We're doing what they called uncontrolled photos of the Rhine River primarily, I didn't know this much at the time, but later found out that we were doing for the Army Map Service with the idea that eventually missiles were going to come in, and the Germans had never really tied the European and the Asian continent together geodetically as far as maps are concerned. So our contribution was taking pictures of the Rhine River. We had a precise altitude to get a pretty close scale that they could work. And anyway, I don't know the results of all that, except we would always get briefed on whether we had covered our assigned or not. We had to have good weather. We operated all the way from the North Sea to Switzerland, taking pictures of the Rhine River. So we did that as a we flew two airplanes every morning. We had two airplanes take off from Sculthorpe and proceed where the RAF weather guessers thought the best weather would be. And if the weather was good, we'd take pictures. If it wasn't, we'd go on an alternate mission of navigation training and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they were typically 8 to 10 hour missions. We'd refuel with a KB-29 about halfway through the mission, and they would come over Europe and do that, and then return to base, and we'd do 8 to 10 hour missions. If we could take photos, always 10 hours. If we could not take photos because of the weather, it'd be a 8 hour mission. Anyway, that was my first experience with jet airplanes, and the RB-45C was a great pilot's airplane.
Why do you say that?
Well, the I'm referring actually to the later B-47, which we transitioned to in 53. Boeing built airplanes for guys that are 6 feet 4 inches tall with long legs and long arms, because your throttle throw, as an example, from idle to 100% would be be like a foot and a half, or maybe a foot. I guess I'm exaggerating a little bit, but the North American, which later was merged with Douglas and then subsequently with back with Boeing years later. But anyway, they built their airplanes from a pilot standpoint. They set the pilot in the seat and built the airplane around him. Boeing built the airplane and then found a place for the pilot.
Mm-hmm.
This is Hal Austin's opinion, not generally accepted anywhere else. But anyway, the B-45 was such a nice airplane. You had good the controls responded easily. We did have hydraulic boosted controls, as all jet airplanes had to have,
sure.
Which became different than the old manual system. And like the C-54 that I flew on the Berlin Airlift, there were no boost on those controls. It was a manual control. Of course, they had them geared such that the C-54 was a nice flying airplane also. But we're going from 150 or 160 miles an hour to, the 350. So there's a huge difference, so you need boost on those controls. Anyway, the B-45 was a nice handling airplane. Not that B-47 wasn't, but I never could. Those guys who used to say the B-47 flew like a fighter never flew the B-45, because there was only B-45 that flew like a fighter, and I think, and B-47 flew like more like a bomber, like it was.
I see.
But anyway, we returned. Then my squadron, instead of coming back to Barksdale, where we had left to go temporary duty in England, we returned to Lockburn Air Force Base, south of Columbus, Ohio. And spent the next better part of 6 years there. We transitioned from the same mission with the RB-45C, visual photo. Post-strike was the, for World War III, was our primary emergency war order mission. My crew's mission most of the time was to take targets of the Moscow area following the bomber strike, and if it had been World War III. That's an oversimplification of how the mission was, but that's basically what it was. So back at Lockburn in 53, we started getting the RB-47 photo airplanes. They were the E model. Initially got the refurbished test airplanes that Boeing had, so we could transition our people from mostly B-29s, B-50s, and so forth into the RB-47, or the B-47 airplane from a crew standpoint. So they assigned us, I don't recall the exact number, but something like 18 former B-47B models. They didn't have ejection seats, but they were basically transitioned for pilots. Well, the transition from B-29 to the B-47 was significant. I'll just throw out one example. By the way, I was an instructor pilot in the B-45. I was an instructor pilot in every airplane I flew from the time I was in the Aviation Cadet program. So I spent probably my flying time is probably at least half of it is all this instructor pilot. But one of the significant things to give you a feel on the B-29, when you're landing, approach for landing, you were shooting for a point within the first 1,000 feet of the runway. With the props, airplanes, you pull those things back and they become almost brakes. You certainly make brakes out of them when you put them in reverse, but just for the, while you're still airborne, when you pull the props back, that tends to slow the airplane down. Well, a jet airplane, especially the early ones, early jet engines, the idle position gave you 40% of power. So instead of, when you pull the engine back to idle, instead of slowing it down or creating a helpful slowdown factor with the props, this thing wouldn't slow down because you're still putting out 40% of the engine power.
Right.
So instead of shooting for a point within the first 1,000 feet of the runway with the B-45 and the B-47, of course I flew the B-45 before, but you had to shoot for a point 1,000 feet short of the runway because you would actually float that much with 40% engine power still going, float that much to catch the first 1,000 feet of the runway. Well, B-45s, we learned to do that well because we were flying off of some 6,000-foot runways. By the time the B-47s came around, though, all the SAC runways had been extended to at least 9,000 feet, some of them as much as 13,000 feet. The one here at March Field, as an example, is a 13,000-foot long runway. So that was because of the effect of the jet engine, the early jet engines. The fan engines don't work quite that same way because with the fans you come back, and then of course they all have reverse to stop on the runway. But the early jet engine, we did not have a reverse factor. The B-47s initially that we had for transition training had a brake chute that you opened to stop the airplane on the runway when you made your final landing. But later we found out they added a smaller chute to use in the traffic pattern so you could actually carry a little power, and then you had that little chute back there help you slow down for landing. I mentioned the landing part because that's where we lost a lot of airplanes early in the B-47 program, is guys going off the other end of the runway. They never got on the runway quick enough, early enough, and they'd run off the other end and tear up the airplane in some cases. Of course, you catch on fire and we lost crews that way. The other factor with those early engines, on the B-47 with a six-engine airplane, you had the two engines on either side close to the fuselage, and then you had number one and number six were out near the wingtip. Well, if you need to go around or for practice landings, either one, when you touch down on the touch and go, as an example, or the regular landing, and you're landing a little high, hot, and overshot, then you're going to go around, so you start applying power. Well, the old prop airplanes, those things would take power. You just take the throttles and ram them forward, and they would spool up, and you got to take off power on again. The early jet engines, especially, didn't work that way. They had a stall factor. So you had to stand the throttles up to let the engine spool up to better than about 65 or 70%. And then you could ram the throttles forward and they would all go. But if you tried to ram the throttles forward like you did with a prop airplane, and number one or number six, the engines they call it an engine stall. It actually would stall out at about 40% power. Okay, if you got an engine on one side going at 100%, the other 40% on the other side, guess what? You're in a significant cartwheel.
Right.
So we lost a number, we lost three B-47s at Lockburn that way. I don't know how many Sykes lost altogether, because as an instructor pilot in the back seat, by the way, it's tandem airplanes. Both airplanes are tandem. A navigator in nose, pilot in front seat, and a co-pilot behind him. They tipped about 8 feet behind the both airplanes were the two pilots. But so my, as an instructor pilot sitting in the back seat, I would hold my hand in front of those six throttles. So on a touch-and-go landing, or if somebody overshot and was trying to go around, I would hold those throttles so that the student pilot could not ram them forward and have number one or number six
stall
out.
Which would probably be their initial reaction is to do that based on their experience.
Well, yeah.
Right.
And these are all experienced guys that were transitioning into the airplane. They've all been flying, you know, had lots of flying time, and, well, some in B-17s, B-29s, B-50s. And we had a handful of B-36 pilots, but not too many of them, because the B-36 was still active at that point. Anyway, that's a whole lot of pilot stuff that a lot of people might not be interested in, but that was my experience as an instructor pilot in the early days of B-47. Later on, they made some modifications to the engines. I don't know the details on that. But they they were still stalled, but they were less susceptible to what you call the engine stall when you jam the throttles forward. But still, the procedure that we talked about all the time, and that included the routine checks that you had to have annually. All crews had to have an annual flight check. And that was another thing we emphasized very strongly about standing those throttles up for and letting the engine spool up before you try to ram them all the way for takeoff. And I know you get panicky, you know, you look up there and see the end of the runway coming up. But if you try to do it any quicker, you're probably going to auger in off the end of the runway. Anyway, so I spent up till May of 54, I was on the combat crew all that time. I was also a standardization board pilot and that sort of thing. Well, April 1954 became a different ballgame for me and my flight crew. Anyway, we were in April, early April, we took eight B-47s and eight KC-97s. By the way, our tanker had been improved to the KC-97. Which was a little faster airplane, still props, but a little faster airplane, and a little easier to refuel behind than the KB-29 was, because they could do it go faster.
Right.
Well, in April, early April of 54, was our first trip of the RB-47s to England, and we went to RAF Fairford down southern England with the 47. And the tankers went to Mildenhall, RAF base. And it's, by the way, Mildenhall is still used for KC-135s these days. But those days, that's where the 97 went. We're over in April. We flew a couple of missions up north around the Scandinavian Peninsula and some down south across Spain. As a matter of fact, we had some assigned practice missions where we did some uncontrolled photography again, as we had done years before in the B-45, of Spain, flying all the way across Spain, taking area pictures, again, for the Army Map Service to try to improve the maps of Spain, tying into France and that sort of thing. So that was kind of an interesting thing. It was not a primary mission, but something we did in lieu of training. Anyway, we came back to Lockburn. We were only gone about, as I recall, about 3 weeks. We were back to Lockburn. And then, that's early April. And then late April, I don't recall the exact date, but something like the 20th of April, 25th of April, the eight airplanes, my crew, I don't remember if there's any changes in the rest of the crews or not, but my crew returned to Fairford again. And the 97's back to Mildenhall. And so on the 6th of May, we had six airplanes, two flights of three B-47s. We had our usual briefing at Old Dark 30, as the Air Force refers to it, early in the morning. It was about a 7 a.m. takeoff. We took off in two flights of three, very loose formation. Refueled with our KC-97 off of Norway's, off of Stavanger, Norway. Again, flying roughly 50 miles off the coast, coast of Norway, Scandinavian Peninsula. We refueled there, went up to a point north of the Scandinavian Peninsula, and there's some Spitsbergen Islands up there that belong to Norway. We took pictures of those, all six airplanes did, at different intervals, of course. We weren't flying formation. We were flying loose formation, mile back station keeping was called. Returned to base, back to Fairford, just a routine training mission. Then on the 8th of May, six airplanes. We went to the briefing, the weather, early morning weather briefing, and the same mission again that we'd flown on the 6th. And so after that general briefing, and the wing commander was over there with us, he grabbed me by the arm and said, bring your crew down here. And so this is after the morning briefing. So we went into one of the study, one of the target study rooms there. You only got a crew of three, pilot, co-pilot, navigator. And our target study rooms were fairly small rooms in the operations building. So we went into that one room, and here's two colonels I'd never seen before. Turns out one of them was from Psych Intelligence, the other from Psych Operations. And they had laid out on our target study table a map. And one of the first things I noticed was Archangels, Murmansk, the northwest corner of the Soviet Union, which was one of our primary entry points for our emergency war order, if we're going to take pictures of a post-strike World War III. So I recognized those areas because we had studied those before for our emergency war order mission. So look at that. It was a strip map. They had put the strip maps together and had a line on Murmansk, Archangels, kind of zigzag a little bit and back out over Finland, Sweden, and Norway. And so the wing commander, by the way, did not stay in the room with us. That was seemed kind of strange to me. So they're just my crew and these two colonels, and they said, this is your mission. What mission? Well, when you get to a point north of 100 miles north of Murmansk with three airplanes, the other three go back where they were on the 6th, but your three airplanes would go to a point 100 miles north of Murmansk. The other two crews are briefed to return to base, and you're to take this route south. Take pictures of nine airfields that interested the SAC and the National Intelligence, wants to know the air order battle. Has the MiG-17 been deployed yet? The MiG-15 was a big airplane for the North Koreans during the Korean War, but the MiG-17 was being developed. Everybody knew that. And by the way, the intelligence guy told us not to worry too much about the MiG-17 because they don't think it's deployed in numbers yet. Well, that turned out not to be correct, not to be the case. We were told on the mission that to get those nine airfields, five in the vicinity of Murmansk and Archangels, and then the other four sort of on the way back out towards Finland. But anyway, one of them is a bomber base also. We knew that the Soviets had developed a bomber that was intercontinental and could strike the United States across the poles. Take a picture of that airfield would find out how many of those airplanes had been deployed. That airfield. I don't recall the names of these airfields. I don't speak English very well, much Russian, much less Russian. So anyway, we were briefed to coast in at 40,000 feet. And I said, wait a minute, we're going to refuel off of Stavanger. We're going to be pretty heavy. Said, climb to 40,000 feet because at 40,000 feet, the MiG-15 can't get that high in the first place.
Right.
And the MiG-17, if they're deployed in any numbers, they both have only a look-and-shoot capability, no radar capability for gun control, so they're a very unstable gun platform at 40,000 feet. Okay. So they briefed all six targets. They had a detailed briefing of the radar photography that had been taken over, developed or from the maps. Navigators had depicted what a radar picture of various airfields might look like. And so the navigator would be from detail on that stuff. The other interesting thing, and would be not unexpected, but the pilots always carried a backup set of maps and so forth for whatever mission we were doing. So they told us to take those out of our briefcase, and including the navigators, and we'll substitute them for you. Well, we never, none of the three of us ever looked at what they had put in that case, but I'm sure it was not where we were going to go.
I would imagine so.
I'm sure it was someplace else, because later on after our mission, the United States Air Force in Europe denied any
right.
U.S. Air Force airplanes in the vicinity of where we were. So anyway, we somebody else had pre-flied our crew for us, so we made took us to the airplane. That was unusual to have somebody else pre-flight your airplane, but we got down to the airplane, and we were actually the sixth airplane to take off, and the second flight of three. Did our refueling. By the way, all in radio silence. Now, during the Cold War, the Soviets had picket ships all the way along the west coast of the Scandinavian Peninsula. So all the stuff we had done on the 6th and again on the 8th were in radio silence with our tankers, radar contact, radar rendezvous, visual refueling, topped off the air and headed their point north, 100 miles north of Murmansk. Well, when at the appointed time, the lead started to turn left, and the fellow on his left a mile back turned left, and we turned right. And old Jimmy Valentine was the lead at that time, and he said he almost broke radio silence when he realized we didn't follow him to find out where the hell we were going. Well, he didn't break radio silence, we never talked about that mission in detail among the crews anyway, because we were always doing weird things like that, and it was just understood that the classification of the mission was such that we didn't swap information like you might think we would, but we didn't. For about 40 years, by the way, at General LeMay's request. So we flew the mission, coasting about 40,000 feet, and it was pretty obvious while we were flying the mission that day, because the weather was clear, very clear for visual photo. This is about high noon, by the way, local time that we're coasting in. 40 years later, we found out on the 29th of April that the RAF crews in three of our RB-45Cs had flown missions over the Soviet Union at night, taking radar scope photography. They had three different routes. We found this out 40 years later. By the way, I've met a couple of the RAF crews. They're both dead now. they took radar scope photography of one of them always as far as Moscow, and back at night, refueled by our KB-29s off of the over the. I'm not sure just where the refueling area was, but so they could get all the way to Moscow and back. That's on the 29th of April, 1954. Here we are 9 days later, and we don't know this, of course. We're coming in at high noon, putting out contrails, well, heck wouldn't have it. And as the co-pilot said later, he felt like they didn't need any radar to look for us. Heavy contrails we're putting out as we coasted in over Murmansk. As you change air masses, we were checking the contrails before when we turned south from a point north of Murmansk. There was no contrails, but obviously got a different air mass, heavy contrails. So we're at 40,000 feet. We climbed up there, and that costs airspeed, of course, when you do that, when you're too heavy. But we coasted in, got the first two airfields in the vicinity of Murmansk, and moved on down towards Archangels, and I guess about halfway to Archangels from Murmansk, co-pilot noticed on the left-hand side, well below us, a flight of MiGs. He thought there were just three of them. I'm sure they were not armed, probably training airplanes, and probably MiG-15s. So we saw two more flights, again on the left-hand side. as we approached Archangels, and again, they were not at our altitude. Well, after finishing the airfield on the south, sort of the south side of Archangels, we had made a big turn back to the right, back towards the southwest. And all of a sudden, I see something going above the canopy and below the canopy both ways. There were tracers. So there were big 17s shooting at us.
Now, were you at still around 40,000 feet?
We're still at 40,000 feet, but that was we didn't stay there very long. when I realized they're shooting at us, first off, we had tested our guns off the coast, by the way, the tail guns. And I told Holler to Holt, you better get turned around. The tail guns, two 20-millimeter cannon, were operated from the co-pilot's seat. He had to turn around backwards and do it by radar. I said, you better turn around and get those guns going back there. We're going to be dead ducks here. So anyway, I pushed the airplane over, went down about 4,000 feet and picked up about 20 knots to indicate airspeed, which further compounded the MiGs problem, I'm sure. These flights saw those tracers. They broke off. They weren't carrying a whole lot of fuel, so any group of airplanes we saw didn't stay with us more than about 5 minutes, maybe 6 or 7 minutes, but not very long. Well, after we turned back to the southwest a little ways, all of a sudden, here's some more, again, coming from the left-hand side. And I know we're going to make a left turn here pretty quick. And by the way, our control of the airplane normally went over to the navigator for target photography. So later on when the airplanes, they were still new. Later on, we had that capability that we used all the time for a target run. We turn the airplane over to the navigator, and he'd actually do the minor corrections. But these early airplanes didn't always work, so my navigator and I did. He'd give me 1 and 2 degree corrections, which is kind of silly, but that's what he'd give me, and I'd try to make them. And for target runs. So anyway, on this second batch of airplanes that were shooting at us, we had to do a hard left-hand turn. They're coming in from the left-hand side, so I do a significant turn to head to the next airfield. We had to do that to get on track. And we think it was about the fourth airplane we did that got a lucky hit. Holt and I tried to figure out later which one it was. I think it was the fourth airplane out of the flight of four. They'd been shooting at us. Got a lucky hit, and the only way we knew we got hit or anything that happened is we lost our intercom. The shell, the 23-millimeter shell, that one shell that hit the airplane, about 12, 15 feet off the left side of the airplane and left wing, a hole on the top of the airplane, later we saw it, about 3 or 4 inches across on top of the airplane, about 8 inches wide on the bottom of the airplane, and we had about 30 holes as the shrapnel hit the left side of the forward main tank area. Well, all the radio equipment in the RB-47 was over the main wheel well, forward main wheel well. Some of that shrapnel that hit in there and knocked out our intercom.
Huh.
It also knocked out the channeling of our radio. More about that a little later. But anyway, that's the only way when you got hit, we lost the intercom. Here I am turning, and the other target comes up here pretty quick. So, by the way, the guns, Holt did get the guns off for about 2 seconds. We were having a heck of a time with those guns. Everything was all new in that airplane, so they were just not working right. But they did fire for about 2 seconds. And I'll guarantee you those Soviet pilots all knew exactly the size of the envelope for our tail gun, which is 20 degrees elevation from the tail and 45 degrees either side of the tail. And they made sure that their approaches to us was outside of that envelope.
Sure.
So anyway, we're making this big turn, and like I said, we lost the intercom, not knowing why. That's the only thing we noticed. And of course, by getting an additional airspeed, that airplane going as fast as we were going and so forth, it's very noisy. I mean, the air noise and everything just deafening. Of course, we had our hard hats on and oxygen on. But anyway, so I hollered at Holt real quick to I had to take my mask off to do that. I hollered at him real quick. I said, get down the aisle here and tell me what heading Vance wants and that sort of thing. Vance Evelyn, by the way, is a navigator. Carl Holt was my co-pilot. Two fantastic guys, good people. Anyway, so he got out of his seat, got down there, and gave me corrections for the next airfield. Vance's corrections, and then we headed on out. In the meantime, that flight, like I say, none of the flights hung around more than 3 to 5 or 6 minutes. And so we thought we were finished with them at that time, and again, we didn't know why we lost our intercom. So we're proceeding on, get the last target, the bomber target. Bomber airfield, by the way, was the one we were turning sharp to get to southwest of Archangel.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that was the bomber base that we were shooting pictures for. Anyway, so we headed on out. We finished the last target, and now we're seeing where we are. Holt's trying to check the fuel and see where we stand. And Vance, by the way, Holt's standing in the aisle of the airplane, passing messages between Vance, Helen, and I.
Sure.
We're reviewing how far we are behind schedule, if we're behind, how the fuel situation looks, and this sort of thing. And as we're approaching Finland, here comes another flight of three airplanes. Now, different than what the newspaper, the Finland newspaper and the Stockholm newspaper said, they said there was foreign airplanes shooting at each other. Well, this three airplanes, I don't think that caught up with us as we're going into Finland. I don't think they were even armed. Because there were no shooting at us. But the one thing that did happen, apparently the lead guy came up and sat right on our right wingtip, just sitting right there. And I'm ignoring him, and then all of a sudden he started dipping towards us. Well, we found out several years later that the Soviet fighter tactics was supposed to be that if they couldn't shoot an intruder down, they were supposed to ram the airplane to knock it down.
Mm.
Well, that's what he was doing, I guess, and I just ignored him and kept going straight ahead. So Holt says that the pilot saluted us before he left. Again, he was only with us about three minutes. And Holt said he saluted him back. I didn't pay any attention to it, but Holt was back up at the back seat by that time because I hollered at him when I saw that airplane pull up there. So anyway, we on out. We're running a half hour to 40 minutes behind our original schedule. Wind's obviously a little different than we'd originally planned. And we're a little behind on fuel. It turns out that these 30-odd holes on the left side of the fuselage, all three main tanks, fuselage tanks in the B-47 were self-sealing. And they obviously worked. As a matter of fact, until my house got robbed back in 05, I had some of the shrapnel that the maintenance guys had taken out of that tank and given to me as a souvenir.
Hmm.
I also have I'm looking at it right now as I talk to you, at a piece of the skin of one of the larger holes. It's about 9 inches across lengthwise where the bullet came in, or the shrapnel came in, and about 6 inches across the hole. They cut a piece out of that fuselage and put it in a little box and presented that to me about 2 months after the mission. So, but anyway, we get back and found run a little behind. Fuel was not too bad. We had a standby tanker off of Stavanger that was we were supposed to be able to call, but so Vance suggested I call him. I started trying to talk on the radio and it wasn't working. I had no feedback from my transmission like you're supposed to get on the aircraft radio. So I assumed maybe that the radio wasn't working. We knew we'd lost our intercom, but we didn't know what else was wrong. So anyway, we proceeded on across Norway and decided we started better climb up to higher altitude and pull the power back a little bit, swapping altitude and RPM for time in the air, just in case we needed it. We had a standby tanker that we were briefed on ahead of time at Mildenhall, and back in those early days, we had our own tankers, and so therefore all of us instructors especially knew each other's voice,
because we worked with their own people all the time, and between the tankers and the bombers. So that became important later on, because about 150 miles north of the Warsh area, Milton Hall is not too far from there, I started calling in the blind for the standby tanker. And it was broken, but the crew was sitting on the ground. This is long before ground alert for SAC. But he was sitting on the ground at the end of the runway, on the taxiway, waiting just in case he got a call. And they had already been told that the other six airplanes, other five airplanes had returned, and that the sixth airplane had not come back yet, because they had no idea what we were doing. The tankers didn't. But Jim Wrigley was the aircraft commander at KC-97, and he said, "You recognize my voice on the radio, and I'm making a blind call for the tanker." And so as a result, he asked for Clarence to take off, get airborne. And the tower wouldn't let him go. He said, "We got an emergency in progress." Well, that's the way things like that always happen. So Jim Wrigley got insistent that if he could give him a guesstimate of how long before the emergency, airborne emergency, was going to occur so he could get airborne. Well, the tower said, finally, reluctantly told him to be about 4 minutes. This is Jim Wrigley telling me all about this years later, months later, I should say. Anyway, so he finally told the tower, "Well, I'm taking off anyway." Well, you can imagine when he got back on the ground, the base commander and everybody else was there ready to court-martial him for taking off. And he did take off, by the way. We got airborne. But we had started letting down to land at Milton Hall. We thought we had enough fuel to get to Milton Hall. We couldn't get back to Fairford, another couple hundred miles further south. So we decided that we could go in to probably make Milton Hall okay with the fuel we had on board. So anyway, he got airborne. The weather was still good. This is late afternoon now. Our mission, our total mission is about 8 hours and a half. So this is late afternoon, and the visibility is still good over the UK, which is not always the case, but certainly was that day. So anyway, as we're letting down, and I'm letting down very slowly, I see KC-97s were new also in those days. That's long before we started painting them. So that aluminum shined real well in the late afternoon sun. Well, I saw what I thought was that tanker. We're probably still at, probably 15,000 feet, something like that, letting down. So I decided that was the tanker, so we headed for him. Well, it turns out we caught him. He hadn't got to only about 3,000 feet by the time we caught him, and didn't have any radios weren't working, so to make sure he knew who we were, I flew under him the OB-45 rendezvous procedures. I flew under the tanker, pulled up in front of him so he could see who we were, and maneuvered back behind. Carl Holt swore till the day he died here about 4 years ago that the wiggling gauges in the early B-47s had the gauges were the wiggling kind. He swore that none of them were wiggling by the time he hooked on that boom.
Is that right?
Well, I'll tell you, that was the quickest hookup that I'd ever made, I think, up to that time with a tanker. And I told Holt, I said, "Check, we get about 10,000 pounds, and we'll click off and go on to Fairford," which we did, using radio out procedures, so forth, landed at Fairford. We had a heck of a crowd there, since we were over an hour late from getting back compared to all the other airplanes. And of course, the first thing we get parked, the crew chief comes up the ladder and says, "What the hell kind of a bird did you hit?" Well, we didn't know. So I did say it wasn't a bird, because seagulls were a problem in the UK, always had been a problem with jet engines. So we could hardly wait to get out of the airplane and see what happened, and we could see the hole in the wing. And the we were very anxious on the radio out procedure landing at Fairford, and were tickled to death when the gear all came down and the flaps came down.
I bet.
Because we weren't sure, had no idea if there was anything wrong with the airplane, except we'd lost our intercom and the radio wasn't working. So anyway, the wing commander then says, "Come with me." We weren't allowed to talk to anybody. We got in his car. Service that we're not normally accustomed to as a Buck airplane crew
right.
Riding with the old man's staff car. He said, go change your clothes into Class A's, and we're going to London to see the ambassador.
Hmm.
So we did that. We got the ambassador's home in London. And the first thing, as soon as we walked in the door, said, maybe you guys like one of these. So we had some old overshoes. I'm not sure what kind of booze it was, but we all three had a nice drink poured for us. Had a drink, and he says, the house may be bugged. Let's go out in the yard. So he went out in the backyard. And the only question he wanted an answer to is the MiG-17. It turned out to be the MiG-17. He wanted to know if how many we saw, and we tried to give him a number and so forth. But said there wasn't any doubt that the intelligence had been wrong on the MiG-17. They're obviously deployed enough numbers for at least three different flights got there out.
Right.
No trouble at all. So the MiG-17. By the way, our film that we took that day proved that, because we got pictures under our black cameras, the K-17 black cameras, that area cameras, that so the intelligence guys figure where you were when you took pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the left of black camera, we got a shot of the MiG-17, and there wasn't any doubt when you blew it up and used the techniques that the intelligence guys used. It was MiG-17, not MiG-15. So we didn't have to. Turned out we didn't have to prove to them they were MiG-17.
Well, you found out the hard way, it sounds like.
Yeah, we did. But anyway, so we finished with the ambassador and had another drink and did some chit-chat. And the old man says, well, let's head back to base. Said, you guys are taking off at 7 in the morning, going to back home, and then to SAC headquarters to brief General LeMay.
Hmm.
So
how'd that make you feel?
I said, that airplane's got holes in it. He said, no, you'll take one of the other airplanes. So we took off next morning, 7 o'clock, refueled, landed at Lockburn, and did get to stay overnight, but this is before Offutt had runways long enough for jet airplanes, so we had to go and fly in a base B-25 in the back end from Lockburn to Omaha. And we got there, and like I say, we're getting attention like you can't believe. We got three staff cars meeting the airplane. There's only three of us. So we got one staff car, and we headed over right over to, I've never been to General LeMay's headquarters at that time. It was in the old Douglas factory building. Went in there and sat down. We saluted appropriately, and he said congratulations on the mission, well done. And I said, well, did we get all the targets? He said, yes, you did. I said, can we see the photos? He said, no, it's too highly classified. Well, hell, you can't see anything 40,000 feet anyway, visually.
Especially if you're not familiar with how the intelligence works in the photo recon.
But anyway, we the first question he asked after the the initial shaking hands and so forth was, John LeMay said, why didn't they shoot you down? Well, we had talked about, my crew and I had talked about what question he might ask, but that was not one that we thought he'd ask right away. So I looked at Holt and says, well, the reason they didn't shoot us down is they were not willing to come up our tailpipes. They respected the envelope of our tail guns, and we'd already told him that the tail guns only fired for about 2 seconds.
Right. Quick. Enough for them to know, though.
So, but that was enough to spook the pilots, the Soviet pilots, and no doubt saved our that's what we, and that took care of that anyway. Otherwise, we described the mission and talked about the number of flights that MiGs that had come up, probably weren't armed, and the ones that did, the two different flights that did shoot at us, flights of four, by the way, all cases are flights of four. And only two of them actually shot at us. So we talked about the flight back over Norway. Well, 2 days later, I've got the copies out of the Columbus Dispatch paper, at Columbus, Ohio Dispatch paper, about the complaints from Finland and Stockholm both about foreigners firing at each other. Anyway,
right.
That's a lot of detail, Kelly, on that mission, but...
No, it's fascinating stuff there, Colonel. It's
well, and, we didn't talk about... General LeMay, by the way, came by Lockburn about 2 months later, I guess it was, 6 weeks anyway, By the way, I'd been taken off a crew because General Eisenhart, well, he was a colonel at the time, wing commander, says your crew's name is in bold letters at the Kremlin, so you're not going to be on a crew together anymore.
Right.
So I put him in maintenance. But anyway, about 6 weeks later, he came by in the airplane. Anytime that KC-97 that he had at that time showed up, of course, everybody got nervous. It wasn't sure why it landed at your base. But we got my crew got a call to gather down to base operations, and the three of us went down. And he came in base operations. We went up to one of the target study rooms in the building, and just the three of us. And again, the wing commander, who was Eisenhart at that point in time, did not come with us. Got inside the room, and he again congratulated us on the mission. And how much help it had been, and so forth, a little bit, and handed us two EFCs.
Is that right?
He said, you deserve the Silver Star. But he said, if I did that, and this is almost literally what he said. I said, I'm giving you two EFCs, and you deserve a Silver Star, but I can do the EFCs, but the Silver Star has got to go to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He says, if I send it to Washington, two things would happen. First off, they'd screw it up, and secondly, there'd be too damn many, and that's the term he used, too damn many people find out about this mission, have no need to know.
Right.
So, anyway, that was it. So, I had trouble the rest of my career of why two DFCs for one mission, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
Well, let me ask you about General LeMay, of course. I mean, he's not just a legend, but he's in charge. I mean, he's quite a character. What was your impression of General LeMay?
Mm-hmm.
What was your impression of General LeMay?
Well, I had a lot of respect for General LeMay and his training system, starting with B-45s. We got very little tech data for our B-45s. Again, this was an economy move on the part of Secretary of State was from the former General Motors. His name was Wilson, and he was called Johnson, and he was called Engine Johnson because he'd been developing engines for the General Motors. He had cut back the buy on the RB-45. He cut back a lot of the testing. We did a lot of the basic testing at Barksdale on those RBCs that should have been done by the contractors. So anyway, as a result of going up with that airplane, Boeing did full testing on the B-47, but still we got the first Arby's built at Lockburn, and we had all kinds of bugs in them. And just like anything else new, there's bugs. You know, the gun. It was another year or so before they ever got the guns where they were when they're probably going to shoot when you pull the trigger,
mm-hmm.
and keep going. You're supposed to be able to fire for 30 seconds, and they wouldn't do that. Other things, the radar hook-in, like I say, with the autopilot and that sort of thing, it didn't work like it's supposed to, and so all that was growing pains. But as a result of the way the direction came back for training, all blamed on General LeMay, of course, but and he had a lot of guys helping him, a lot of fantastic people helping him. But I always had a lot of respect. You had to have respect for that guy. Of what he was forcing, trying to build the greatest armada that had ever been developed for SAC, you know, for the Cold War.
Sure.
So by the way, the only other time I'd ever seen him before this mission, he came into Lockburn one time in a B-45, long before we got the 47s. And my buddy Jack Emerson was a senior to me on an instructor pilot. So he took General LeMay for a RB-45C flight out of Lockburn. Well, after he flew with Jack Emerson, he came into our squadron, and we knew he was going to come in there, and he chatted with us a little bit about that. And he was, you know, he didn't talk a whole lot, but what he said was worth listening to. So that was another reason I respected him, because the way he handled us crew members sitting there, Buck Krumers and squadron after he took that flight with Jack Emerson and what he thought about the airplane, that sort of thing.
Hmm. Yeah.
One other incident I need to throw out about General LeMay, though. I don't know whether you're aware or not, but in that era, we used to have, instead of the air show every year, we had car races. General May was a real fan of car racing. So he would shut down, and we had it at Lockburn on two different occasions. But the first one, we shut down all flying and so forth, and it's an open house like you do for air shows and that sort of thing. But it's all for car racing. They'd race down the runway, and they had procedures and so forth set up for it. Well, we had some old World War II small hangars built for the nose on a B-17 at Lockburn. We're still using those for the 45s and so forth. They were big enough for that. Anyway, so we had moved all the airplanes out of there so that the guys were their cars. And I don't remember how the invitation set up for cars, but there was, 25 or 30 cars, racing cars, designed for racing. They were standard cars, but they were souped up for racing and this sort of thing. And General May had one. Well, it turns out he was in the B-45 hangar nearest our squadron. So... at late in the afternoon, I don't remember exact the reason why, but the word was out after 6 a.m. or 6 p.m. or something like that. I don't remember the time exactly, but this gives you an idea what it was, that they were supposed to get out of their car maintenance and shut it off until the next morning, which was race day. So anyway, I can't remember the guy's last name, but we had a big, tall black sergeant. He was a fantastic individual, master sergeant. And so he was told to go out and tell these guys in the hangars in their cars. They had three or four guys in our little hangar there with cars. Told to go out and tell them to knock it off, and it was time to shut down. This is part of the ground rules. So anyway, he told everybody in there, okay, time to shut down and get the hell out of here. Well, he was in deep shock when about the last guy of the hangar with General May in a pair of coveralls, you know, he'd been working on his car. And you talk about a sergeant that thought he was going to be court-martialed immediately. It was so funny, because he came back into the operation where a lot of us were sitting and said, "My God, I just run General May out of the hangar." Anyway, car racing, that was some event.
It sounds like it. Sounds like it would have been. All right, now this takes us into the spring of 1954. Now, where are you going to be based out of at this point?
I'm sorry?
Where are you going to be based out of at this point, spring of 54?
Oh, spring of 54, we're at Lockburn.
Okay,
we're at Lockburn Air Force Base.
All right, very good, very good.
And then Lockburn Air Force Base, I went up there in 51, and we came back from our TDY in England 3 months. Back to Lockburn. We never went back to Barksdale. We departed Barksdale and come and returned to Lockburn Air Force Base after those 3 months. And I was there until I went to Command Staff School in the summer of 58.
Okay, so you're there for quite a while then.
Yeah, for a long time. Well, that was typical in those days. A lot of people stayed at the same base during the SAC buildup and B-47s, B-47 era especially, and then early 97s. And then early 52s and 135s, it was not unusual to have guys be in one base for 10 years.
Hmm. All right. Now, what else are you going to be doing here? You've got another 4 years at Lockburn. What else are you going to be doing here?
Well, I was spending, I made chief of maintenance. I was a major this time and made chief of maintenance and was the SAC maintenance system General May had set up centralized maintenance instead of the way it is now and was before, where a squadron had their own operators, pilots, crews, and so forth, and their own maintenance squadron. Well, and as part of the changeover, and starting with B-29s, as a matter of fact, you had the chief of maintenance, in which all three maintenance squadrons, well, actually four maintenance squadrons, because they had the 97s as well, and the armored electronics and so forth, all reported to the chief of maintenance rather than their squadron commander. So I was made chief of maintenance as a major, which in the 8th Air Force at the time, General Sweeney, Walter C. Sweeney, was the 8th Air Force commander at Westover, And I was the only, we had, he used to have commander's conferences twice a year. And the first one we had after I became chief of maintenance, I was the only major chief of maintenance in all of 8th Air Force. And so every time he turned around, he'd call on me to answer some question that he said about maintenance. And I got kind of nervous about that. But anyway, Wing Commander always said I did a good job on the thing. So I got promoted to LC out of that. So I guess it was okay.
Yes, sir. Sounds
but
like
anyway, it's maintenance business. I stayed in maintenance the rest of the time I was there. I was still an instructor pilot and a flight test pilot. We used, in those days, we still flight tested airplanes after maintenance and a lot of different maintenance things. And so I flew quite a bit some as an instructor pilot, but as a check pilot, I tested most all the airplanes after maintenance. We had 48 B-47s assigned and 20 KC-97s, so it was a huge outfit.
Yes.
We had, around 18 base flight airplanes too in those days. So that was a huge job, but had some fantastic people working for me. So it's great. So that's why I went to Command Staff School in the summer of '58 to Maxwell Field for 1 year, and then out of Maxwell Field got assigned to SAC headquarters. So we moved back to Offutt then. In 59, and I stayed there until '64. There I was initially assigned to the as I guess would figure I'd been in the reconnaissance and operations, so I was in ops plans SAC headquarters operations in the reconnaissance shop. And there we were our job was to come up with the directions and so forth from SAC to the recce airplanes, not only the visual photo recce, but the electronic countermeasure and all that kind of stuff too. So,
right.
Also, I got in some of the SAC headquarters, some of the initial R&D stuff. We'd have contractors come in proposing something else for SAC, and I was one of the junior guys in that. And I worked in the underground at SAC for those 6 years. I got accepted for War College in 64, and my boss wouldn't let me go because they decided to put the, as you may recall from previous guys, they decided SAC was going to participate in the Vietnam War, so I was selected as one of the two or three guys to go down to we used attack airplanes at Eglin Air Force Base to figure out how to drop iron bombs out of the B-47, was what we started with. You could put nine 750-pound bombs in the bomb bay. We came up with a MIR rack that the fighters used to put on the hard points where drop tanks normally fit it on the B-47. So you could add six bombs on each wing for that. Did a lot of testing down there, and I wound up running that for quite some time. And then later, after all this time we spent on the B-47, we were dropping inert bombs initially, and then we got in dropping live bombs on out of Eglin, using SAC airplanes and APGC, American, APGC, Air Proving Ground, I forget what that letter stand for. But this was the technicians. To give you an example of what they were doing, we didn't have, we were still using World War II bombs and World War II fuses. So in order to take an inert bomb to know how soon a bomb arm dropping out of the bomb bay, the technicians down there came up with an idea of using a photo flash bulb that you use in a camera to have it trigger. So when you your fuses had a little prop on the end of them that turned when brought in the windscreen after you dropped out of the bomb bay, it would spin up, and then depending on how you set the thing, it would arm the bomb.
I see.
Well, the first thing you're worried about the B-47, that was scary as heck because we had high-speed cameras checking this with inert bombs. And those bombs, old World War II bombs, falling out of an airplane going, 350 knots instead of 150, like
right,
the 17s did.
Much faster planes,
and
yes.
They come out of there, and the bombs are bouncing against each other and that sort of thing. So it's scary as hell. And then we found out that the arming of the bomb, some of them armed within a second of the time they were released. Well, hell, you couldn't have that, because if they bump against each other, then you're going to blow up an airplane.
Right.
So we peddled around with a lot of stuff over a period of about 6 months, back and forth to Eggman. I had to, but General Power was commander of SAC by that time, and I had to go back once a week and brief him on our progress. About the time we thought that a lot of things sorted out in the B-47, they decided to go and do it with the B-52. So we started over with the 52s. Found out that the back end of the bomb bay and the 52s, while they could carry, 50, I think the number was 54 bombs in the bomb bay we were using the D model primarily, or the C model, I guess. They same size bomb bay anyway. We found out that the iron bombs would not drop out of that back end of that bomb bay. They'd hang up. They'd be float back there, tend to float.
Hmm.
We were afraid they were going to hit the airplane. So we came up with some guide bars, come up with, again, the technicians at Eglin did this, use back airplanes. Come up with a way to build out of aluminum some guides so that those tail fins, how the bombs would come straight down. And anyway, we tried down on two or three different missions, finally found something that worked. So all this took time, but we were flying. I remember B-47 crews wasn't so unusual to have them fly the same airplane a couple times the same day, but for B-52, it was unheard of. So I remember we got to get the biggest kick out of those SAC crews down there. We'd say, we'd fly the first mission about 8 in the morning, and we'd be back here at 1 o'clock for the next mission. You going to fly this airplane twice in one day? Anyway, so that was really interesting. I spent a lot of time there, wound up just ahead of finally getting to go to the War College in 65. I went to Guam, deadhead over there in 135 and so forth, get to Guam to take the manually derived bombing tables for the first 52s over there on how to drop those airplanes, how to make sure the bombs came out on time, how to do the interval setting, all that kind of stuff. Because these are guys that had not dropped the iron bombs except the ones we tested at Eglin. And so I went over there with a navigator, and we briefed all of the combat crews over there on how to do it based on our experience at Eglin. So then I went back to Maxwell for Air War College. And now the Air War College, I was going to the Pentagon. I suppose that was a given, although a lot of guys were going to Vietnam, out of the War College. But it turns out my iron bomb experience at Eglin was for SAC and so forth put me in the J-3 operations, Pacific Division of J-3, in the Joint Staff. So I joined that. We worked in the double vault in the Pentagon. And way back there, and everybody smoked in those days, so got kind of an interesting standpoint. Anyway, my iron bomb experience was what we were using. Of course, all of a sudden, instead of just worrying about SAC bomb iron bombs, I'm worrying about the iron bombs on attack airplanes and everybody else as well, even the Navy. Being a joint staff, of course, we had all services represented. And one of my best buddies I play golf with here in Riverside to this day, so Alan Hill, and he was a commander at that time, and I was lieutenant colonel still. We did as a team, and usually we had to go with anytime we went to brief DOD or the generals and so forth, and admirals in the building. We'd usually send both the Air Force and the Navy, sometimes the Marine pilots. So Hill and I did a number of briefings together along that line, and he was a little smarter than I was. He didn't spout off at the wrong time like I did. He made the two-star admiral, and I retired as a colonel, of course. But anyway, we still play golf here at Victoria Club in Riverside together. And we were stationed at Pentagon together for a little better than 2 years on a joint staff, briefing different people together. So that's quite an experience.
Well, let me ask you about this, Colonel. You talk about your experience with the joint staff. Of course, this is going to be it's going to have a lot of different issues, inter-service issues.
Oh yeah.
And especially someone who worked with SAC for the amount of time that you had.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you can describe for me the relationship between the different services dealing with the issues of the air war in Vietnam.
Well, it was the services got along better than we did with DOD. Now, remember, McNamara was Secretary of Defense,
mm-hmm.
and he had his quiz kids there. Well, one of the things we found out pretty early, and Hill and I and the other guys, too, it wasn't always just Hill and I, sometimes some other Navy guy and so on. But when our normal procedure was, if our number one problem was keeping a war plan up to date to go into North Vietnam with a mass force and force the issue to end that war. That's what we were assigned to do, to keep a war plan current, using not only all the fighters, Navy, Air Force fighters, and so forth, but also the SAC bombers to take out North Vietnam. Well, years later, we found out that the civilians were not going to let us do that. But we always thought, all the time I was there, that our primary job was to keep that current and make sure that we figure out a way to take out all of North Vietnam's military forces. So that's what we're trying. And normally our briefings, we'd be put together. We would take bits and pieces of it, and we'd get it cleared through the joint staff. And the joint staff, we had a two-star level of JCS that we would usually brief first after we come up with it and the action officers come up with it. We'd break the two-star level, and then sometimes we'd go straight to the four-star, or sometimes there'd be also a group of three-stars. Sometimes you'd go to those to brief them, too. But after we'd been there a little bit working on the conventional bombs, the weapons to do this in North Vietnam, all of a sudden we got to go brief some of the quiz kids. And these guys were not still wet behind the ears, you know. They're young guys. And we were told, well, go brief them, but be careful what you say. You know, they're civilians, and we got more trouble there. Us action officers trying to dance between what these civilians thought they knew and what they didn't know. But so I can't give you a real specific example, but let me give you generally how some of the feedback occurred.
Please do.
We would update. Typically, we'd have to go brief the chiefs, and that includes the four stars, at least once a month, and then finally it'd become more about once every 2 months. But I was on the briefing team, and we'd go in, and I had just a portion of the briefing, of course. We'd give them a rundown on how we're going to bring the forces together over North Vietnam to take out all the targets and all the military targets. And I had a piece of that briefing each time. Well, we would find out that we had to go brief some of the quiz kids first, one or two of them. Then we'd wind up through our military level up to all the way to the four stars. And then we'd get the feedback there that what the quiz kids had told McNamara, that he told the chiefs, were different than what we were saying.
Is that right?
This was, yeah. Now, I can't give you a specific example. But more than once, we sat there, and us action guys with our mouth hanging open, when one of the chiefs would come back and say, well, this is what Secretary of Defense said. And so that was where the, as far as I'm concerned, there was more conflict there than there was between the services.
Hmm.
And McNamara was the world's worst Secretary of Defense, and, of course, history proved that. But at the time, we were stuck dealing with him, whether liked it or not. There's really no really arguments between Air Force and Navy. The Marines were involved too with a lot of that stuff, but we all got along pretty good. Anytime, by the way, I went to Southeast Asia, I think 4 or 5 times each year for 2 years there, And we'd go over, we'd have to go to St. Pac in Hawaii and as action officers and brief their action officers on what we were on the latest plans and so forth, and then go all the way to Saigon and brief them. Sometimes we'd go to Task Force 77 and talk to the admiral out there that's in charge of that. So this was got to be a routine thing, and then after we were in country for our briefings there, then we'd come back and have to stop at St. Pac on the way back and talk with them. And anyway, Admiral McCain was the commander in chief at part of that time of St. Pac, you know, the Pacific Forces. And on one occasion, I'll never forget this, we were in there with his action officers that we'd got to know pretty well over the time on, you know, two or three different trips that I'd been on and the guys I was with. And so we're sitting there debriefing on our way back towards Washington, and Admiral McCain comes in, sits down with us, and we discussed the whole plan that, with him, like he was one of the action officers. I was really impressed with that guy. Here's a four-star sitting down with a bunch of lieutenant colonels and commanders. Anyway, that was a side issue, but I really had didn't have much differences between the services. The problem was with DOD.
Well, now you make these trips to Saigon, and I guess this is what, 65, 66, somewhere in this area?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, 66, no, 66. I went to Pentagon, I finished command staff school in the summer of 66, class of 66. So I went to Pentagon then, I was there in 67, and up to the Tet Offensive in 68. All these my trips were made before that time. After the Tet Offensive, we didn't go back, I didn't go back again until 69, I went back to SAC.
All right, now you've been over there a number of times into Saigon.
Oh, yeah. And by the way, we used to, on some of the trips, we had to go out in the field, and we always, they always sent the Air Force guys had to go out with the Army. I don't know, sometimes the Navy guys went, sometimes they didn't, but the Army guys loved to put us right next to bed us down in a tent, right next to where the 105 howitzers were working all night. And I got to spend two nights on the DMZ with the Marines. And again, I'm right next to 105 howitzers going off most of the night. But I tell you, the being on the joint staff, they were all very careful dealing with us, of course. And,
sure.
I felt a little standoffish any time they were talking to guys from the joint staff, you know. But anyway, the cooperation between the services was, as far as I'm concerned, was great then.
Having gone to Saigon a number of times and having paid attention, obviously, to what's going on in the newspapers and listening to other military experts like yourself, what was your feeling of the way the war was going, say, from 65 up to prior to Tet of 68? What was your feeling on the progress of the war?
I couldn't understand, and we remember action officers discussed it a lot. We couldn't understand why we were not executing some of the plans that we'd put together. We just could not understand why. So, like I say, it was years later before we realized that the... I think Lyndon Baines Johnson was probably the sorriest president we ever had, next to Carter anyway, and then Obama. But anyway, Johnson insisted, first on the B-52s, Johnson insisted on getting briefed on the targets for the, you know, for the boxes we use for target for carpet bombing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he insisted on picking the targets in Washington. Well, by doing that, the North Vietnamese had those targets before the flight crews probably got them. That was our opinion anyway, because carpet bombing was not nearly as effective as it should have been, because with the targets being picked in Washington and the intelligence systems work like they do, the North Vietnamese would clear those boxes out of their troops. So that's just one other thing that, but like I say, the whole feeling was, is why can't we go in? You know, we only briefed the senior guys at on the war plans in Southeast Asia, and we're down here, wherever we'd be, into the Task Force 77. But we're talking about what we could do and what their responsibilities would be in the action, and it was always a question to us, is why can't we execute one of these?
What was the feeling of the people on the ground there in Saigon?
Well, I'm not. They're more concerned about the day-to-day.
Sure.
All the places that I had a chance to visit during Vietnam was, all of them seemed to have about the same attitude. You know, their concern was their immediate problem right where they were,
mm-hmm.
because they never knew when the Viet Cong was going to do something to get to them. And I think that was probably all the way through, all the way up to the 68 Tet Offensive.
Right.
And but the local guys, they worried about the local problems and not concerned with it so much with the big picture. That was my opinion at the action officer level.
Well, that would make sense too, obviously.
Hmm?
I said that would make sense too.
Yeah,
I would
think. That's my in my recollection and has been all along. Mm-hmm.
Now, the Tet Offensive of 68 changes a lot of things in
a lot of
different ways.
Yeah. Changed everything.
What was your opinion of the effect of the offensive on the operations for which you were responsible
again, we're back to the same thing. Why didn't we execute our war plans that we had developed in the joint staff against North Vietnam? Why didn't we do that before the Tet Offensive occurred?
Mm-hmm.
That was the question we, as action officers always said, why can't we do that? So after the Tet Offensive, though, it's pretty obvious that the war is lost. And I don't know. You know, it was said, I read it in different places and heard some opinions about it that we probably could no longer have handled North Vietnam without atomic weapons.
Hmm.
I don't know if that's true or not. I do know that the plans we had during the 68 time frame before Tet Offensive, the 67-68 time frame, I think we could execute those plans with the fighters and the bombers that North Vietnamese would holler calf rope right now and wanted to get out of that war.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never allowed to happen.
Right.
So as far as I'm concerned, all of, virtually everything we worked on for the 3 years I was in the Pentagon was pretty well worthless, because none of it was ever used, or not very little of it was ever used.
What is your opinion of the lack of willingness to extend the bombing campaign when it was halted, extended into North Vietnam, bombing sites like Hanoi, the mining of the harbors? Why weren't these things pursued as legitimate goals or legitimate targets for SAC?
Direct answer to your question is I don't know, except all the things we set up, including the mining of the harbor, stuff like that, was all part of a plan. We had different phases of it that could be done. Like I say, we worked our tails off every month updating that thing and what we could do based on the forces that were available and that sort of thing. And just never could understand why none of it was executed. And very frustrating at the time. And only years later when we realized that that for some reason or other, the civilians thought they couldn't do it. Well, you know, LBJ was pretty well quoted as saying that he was worried about the Chinese,
mm-hmm.
and rightly so. In my personal opinion is the Chinese weren't capable of doing anything at that point. But he worried about the Chinese and also the Soviets,
mm-hmm.
What they might do if we executed part of our war that we'd worked on all the time for North Vietnam. North Vietnam. So I think that's probably the big item. They were the only thing that makes any sense to me is they were worried about what China and/or the Soviet Union might do.
Mm, right.
The Soviet Union had furnished the SAM missiles, knocked down several B-52s and that sort of thing. They'd furnished the SAM missiles to North Vietnam. So would they follow up with something more drastic? I don't know. I guess that's what scared off the politicians. I'm not sure.
Well, you bring up a good topic that I wanted to get to. What about these SAMs? You have these surface-to-air missiles that are eventually going to be deployed during this time,
yeah.
And they're used to pretty good effect eventually.
Well,
how did that change planning?
The countermeasures that we had available, and again, I don't know the details on the countermeasures on the 52s, but obviously they didn't work in some cases, because I don't remember how many B-52s lost, but we lost several of them due to the SAMs. The fighter guys, my younger brother, by the way, was flying F-105s out of Thailand.
Hmm.
He did 100 and some odd missions altogether, 105. And they were pretty good at the weasel guys with the F-4 weasels, and the fighters were pretty good at taking out those sites. But again, they were not allowed to this is my discussion with him later, you know, years ago. They were not he thought they should be allowed to get in closer to Hanoi for some of those SAMs that they were not allowed to get into.
Right.
To try to knock them out. So I don't know the enough details to really discuss it, Kelly, on that stuff. I was long since out of the 52s at that point.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what capability had to counter the SAMs, if they were supposed to be able to misdirect the SAMs and that sort of thing, and the weasels were supposed to be able to divert some of the SAMs during the B-52 missions and so on. But obviously, it didn't always work. Well, never you know, what you plan and so forth never works totally in war anyway.
Sure. Well, why don't we stop there for today, Colonel?
Okay.
This is Kelly Krager continuing an oral history interview with Colonel Harold Austin. Today is 2 October 2012. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Colonel Austin is joining me by telephone from his home in Riverside, California. Okay, Colonel. Now, 1969, I believe you go back to SAC, as you were mentioning, and you go to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Can you explain the nature of your position there at Wright-Patt?
Okay, yeah, my three-year tour in the Joint Staff was up in 69, so I returned to SAC at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the SAC's 17th Bomb Wing, B-52s and KC-135s. SAC was in a position on what we call the other side of the base at Wright-Patterson for a number of years, and but I was there 69 to 71. As the vice wing commander, 17th Bomb Wing, and for those 2 years, and we were a bomb outfit, B-52Hs. Those airplanes, by the way, are still flying today. That I flew way back then, and of course the 135s are still flying as well. Of course, SAC left the Wright-Patterson a few years after that, and the Air Force Reserve has been in there ever since. That's a separate story. Anyway, after 2 years as the Vice Wing Commander, we competed in the bomb navigation competition both years. Did well, but didn't win any of them. It was a great organization, and we're always in direct competition with everybody else in SAC at the time, because we had the newest airplanes. Newest B-52s anyway, and the 135s were all in good in those days too. So nothing unique about that 2 years. I got my feet back on the ground, checked out in the 52 and 135, of course. Did some a couple of fighter drags to Vietnam. By fighter drags, I'm talking about we had Tanker Task Force Commander. We'd assembled usually at March Field. Then the fighters would be wherever they're going to come from. Anyway, we would pick them up off the coast of California, and always went to Hickam and Hawaii, refueling the fighters, of course, en route. We'd spend the night there and then take off the next day. Depending on the weather, winds really was a big problem. We'd take off sometimes for all the way to Kadena with the fighters going into Japan, or we'd go to Guam and then to Vietnam. It would depend on how the winds were on which one we did. I did about three of those while I was vice commander at Wright-Patterson. Also did a couple of fighter drags, that we called it, to Europe, where the fighter units were replacing ones that had been gone in Europe, you know, for 6 months or whatever the time was. In those cases, we would operate out of Goose Bay, typically. We'd take maybe 20 or 25 tankers into Goose Bay, Then we would get them airborne, go into the air refueling position and refuel the fighters. Coming out of the States, we'd take them halfway across the Atlantic, and tankers out of the U.K., typically out of the U.K., would pick them up there and take them on in country.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting operation. All those things got to be fairly routine. The one thing we guys and the tankers always figured that the fighters always stayed pretty close in when you're over an awful lot of water. It's amazing how that works.
I'm sure that would be the case.
But anyway, that was the interesting times. I did a couple of those to Europe and a couple to the Pacific, maybe three to the Pacific, if I recall properly. Anyway, after those 2 years, McConnell Air Force Base had been the 23rd Attack Fighter Wing, had been there for a number of years with F-105s, and SAC was going to take the base over. They had a SAC Titan missile wing already in place at McConnell, and so they're going to put in a SAC wing at McConnell 135s and B-52s. So I became the commander of the first and 91st Strat Recon Squadron of 135s, and then become the 384th refueling wing with two squadrons of 135s. The B-52s was finally changed. I got there in 71, and in 72 they scrubbed the 52s, increased our 135s from 12 to 20. Then I don't recall the exact date it was, but late 72, they changed it to an air refueling wing, give us, I think it was six more airplanes, if I recall, 135s, and two squadrons, and become a 384th air refueling wing. That was one of the early air refueling wings, only 135s, had become more normal as we moved on down the pike, so to speak, in SAC. I was there 2 years. We also had the Huey helicopters, three Huey helicopters that supported the Titan missile wing. With their Titans were deployed, of course, around the area. Titan missiles were deployed around the area, and the Hueys were used to take crews out and our maintenance people out. A lot of the crews drove, some of them wanted to fly, and anyway, the Hueys we used to support that outfit. I was not allowed to get, I owned those three helicopters, so while I wasn't allowed to check out in them as a wing commander, I got to fly them quite a bit. That was my only experience with helicopters. That was was different. But anyway, we were in competition there for the SAC bombing competition, air refueling part of it. And that sort of thing. Didn't win anything, but was interesting. At one unique event that occurred while I was Wing Commander McConnell, on one of our annual air shows back in those days, we had the Thunderbirds in. My brother Jim was at Grand Forks flying B-52Gs. My brother Don, the fighter pilot, was stationed at Tucson flying A-7s.
Hmm.
And so we, Jim brought a B-52 in from Grand Forks for our ground show, air show, and Don flew an A-7 in from Tucson. And so the three of us brothers got made quite a bit of news there at the time. So as a matter of interest and a little news action as well, when the air show was over with and Jim and Don were going to go back to their respective bases, we decided to do a token air refueling. I was flying a tanker, 135, and we gave a token offload to B-52 Jim and his route back to Grand Forks, and to Don his A-7 back to Tucson.
Hmm.
So we got a little press out of that. That
yeah.
was a sort of interesting sidelight. My brother Jim passed away in December of 10. My brother Don has been retired from the Air Force now, lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Hmm.
But that was just a side issue. So after 2 years there, which was typical of commanders, I got moved to 15th Air Force Headquarters here at Marge Field. I've been trying to get stationed in California my whole Air Force career, and finally made it out here. But it didn't last very long. I came out here in 73, and then in 74, even though Utapao Air Base in Thailand, where the 52s and 135s were operating, it was a PACAF base. Mm-hmm. But all the base commanders, since the Vietnam War was underway, had been SAC guys, and I got selected for that assignment. So in July of 74, I initially went to the Philippines, where I got briefed in there from the 7th Air Force, the 13th Air Force Commander there on what we were supposed to be doing and that sort of thing, because it belonged to PACAF after all, instead of SAC, even though it was basically a SAC base at Utapao. So in brief there, and then arrived in Utapao and took over the SAC. Typically had at least 15 B-52s and around 20 135s always there. During the late 74 and early 75, we had a buildup of additional airplanes. And as I recall, we had 30 B-52s and 40 135s on the base at one given time for the big push in the December of 74 against the North Vietnam. So I was not involved directly in the bombing. It was just to support the base support there for the B-52s, 135s. The SAC was the biggest of 18 tenant units. MAC had a position there. Military Airlift the Command had a position there. C-130s out of Clark on temporary duty. We typically had about anywhere from 10 to 20 130s at any given time. We also had the Army, some Army airplanes there that supported base Sadiq base, which was 6 miles away on the Bay of Siam. So we had the I think they called A-12s. I can't remember now for sure. They're twin-engine turboprop airplanes that supported the Army. And they had a snooping mission that they used those airplanes for, and I never knew the details. We had a big Red Horse unit there that was outfitted to build runways wherever it was required. It was a huge squadron. So I had some 6,000 military personnel on Utapao and 4,000 Thai employees support people at Utapao. So it was a huge base, lots of activity going on. We worked around the clock 7 days a week in support of the Vietnam War. And so it was kind of an interesting time for many aspects. excuse me. And the things were, I suppose you could call them, fairly routine. By the way, let me divert just a minute back to the base commander job. I was responsible for a number of what I used to call cats and dogs outfits around Thailand, including a group up at Chiang Mai, had a group up there of military guys and a bunch of civilians who ran a radar snooping operation watching Chinese launching missiles and that sort of thing, a very top secret green door type activity. But my base had to support those guys. We had three different small units in Bangkok that we supported. So my instructions were that I had to go visit those places at least once or twice a month, and that included Chiang Mai, which no doubt you've heard about. Chiang Mai was a nice resort area in northern Thailand, a beautiful place to go. Anyway, I had no problem going up there at all. And many times I would, C-130s would drop me off up there, or even the Army occasionally, those A-12s, and sometimes they go by commercial by Thai Air. Anyway, it was an interesting thing trying to keep up with all these things, because I had a nice staff, a great bunch of people at Utapao to help with all that activities. So, things, I guess, were sort of normal, you might say, until the 31st of January of 1975, when the Khmer Rouge closed the Mekong at Phnom Penh. We started an airlift. We already had a mini airlift going in with C-130s. That's part of the why the C-130s are there, was in support of the good guys in Cambodia. But anyway, when the Khmer Rouge took over on the 31st of January, we got a serious airlift going with C-130s, and they brought in eight DC Stretch H civilian airplanes on the contract into my base, and we started an airlift into Cambodia that was reminiscent of my time on the Berlin airlift, mm-hmm. except this time I'm in a command position instead of an airplane driver. So we had loaded pallets, and normally MAC, Military Airlift Command, loaded the pallets, and themselves, you know, whatever the materials are you're putting on board the pallets that fit on the 130s or and later the Stretch 8s, DC-8s. so we didn't have anywhere near enough loading crews. So we queried MAC headquarters about how long it would take to train some crews. They give us some figure like 18 months. Well, I had a lot of people on the base. A lot of them were not very busy. They were always standing by to be busy.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the local MAC guy said, well, look, and the Red Horse outfit, some of the other tenant units, says we can provide people to solve a in-house organizational problem. We decided, of course, the weather is tropical at Utapau. So we said, okay, everybody can wear their normal baseball cap for their unit cap, but no shirts. We'll wear white T-shirts. Well, anyway, the MAC guys and got out and started training people, and we were turning out new loading crews in a matter of about 10 days, working essentially around the clock. It was the greatest, and it improved the heck out of my disciplinary problem, because now we had a lot of guys that normally didn't have much to do, were being kept busy loading C-130s and pallets for the C-130s and the Stretch 8s.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an interesting time. Unfortunately, it didn't last too long, because I recall the one incident in particular, we had additional C-130s, by the way, brought in, and in addition to those Stretch 8s, DC-8s. But the DC-8s were, of course, flown by civilians. The C-130s, as a matter of fact, some of those crews were what they call ship-dipped. They were came back to the States and got out of the Air Force and become civilians. And that turnaround for the 130 crews took about 5 days. They'd be back to the States and then back as a quote civilian unquote
mm-hmm.
Crew flying those 130s. I never could quite understand why all that was necessary, but somebody decided it was. So anyway, we had theoretically, technically, civilian crews flying those C-130s, and then of course civilian contract crews flying the Stretch DC-8s. So anyway. When that all started coming to an end, when I used to meet some of the DC-8 pilots and some of the C-130 guys just to see how it was going. I had my guys out there doing all the coordination anyway. It was excellent. Everything was running like clockwork. So I got a call from one of my cops on the RIC, the hand radio we carried all the time. Said, Colonel, maybe you need, if you're in a position to get out here, maybe you ought to come watch this, see this DC-8. So I drove over on the ramp and up to the airplane, and the cop was looking at it, and we counted eight small arms bullet holes on the bottom of the DC-8.
Hmm.
The crew hadn't got out of the airplane yet. They were doing what they do up there, because that was only about a 15-minute flight, so we'd load the airplane. They'd do as many as four or five flights during daylight into Phnom Penh before this occurred. Well, when the captain saw me pull up out there, he got out of the airplane, come down, and said, that's it. No more flights for me into Phnom Penh. So the airlift we ran was going like great guns for almost 6 weeks before it all came to a screeching halt. And then the U.S. gave up on Phnom Penh. But that was a very interesting sidelight. Then, of course, A little earlier, we put on the big push to be the B-52s and 135s and the additional fighter 135s supporting fighters as well as 52s into North Vietnam during the December heavy raids of 74 against the North Vietnamese. So anyway, it was quite an interesting tour. And then when the Cambodia collapsed then on the beginning, about the middle of February, we got a, received a number of Cambodian airplanes and mostly Cambodian military. Some of them brought their families and so forth into Davao. We set up a tent city for them. With plenty of land available for that sort of thing at Davao. So the Red Horse guys put up tents, put in wood floors and things like that. A very good way of making those things happen pretty quick. Of course, this is their training, what their training is all about. The Red Horse was an engineering outfit. So I don't recall the exact number of people we had from Cambodia there, but then as we got a little closer to the collapse of Saigon, or the then things really got interesting. Utapau is about 350 miles mostly west of Saigon, but on April 29, 1975, that was the North Vietnamese that overtook South Vietnam at that time. I got on over 2 days, April 29th, 30th, I got 165 South Vietnamese aircraft, which included a lot of F-5s, the Vietnamese Air Force, some A-37s, which were combat airplanes also. I got nine C-130s, several C-47s, around 16 or so, a number of A-1s, that was the SPAD, they called it, the Air Force SPAD. The Vietnamese had some of those. Got some AC-119s, those were airborne gunships. A number of other airplanes, some U-17s and C-7s, several O-1s, and a whole bunch of helicopters. Anyway, they made some way or another, they got all the way to Utapau. And so now we've got a little bit of a problem. We had the Cambodians in there since April the 12th, had built their area for them, Tent City. Well, we found out real quick, I guess a lot of people already knew that, but I didn't. By the way, I had the U.S. Embassy in Bangkok during this time frame had at least two people with me all the time trying to work the Secretary of State problems with us. They were a great help. Unfortunately, in February, the ambassador got recalled. He was drunk, and he finally got recalled. So we're going through all this without an ambassador. Well, I'd never worked very much with State Department folks before, even though these were great people. But I found out they can't make a decision that without going to Washington when there's no ambassador. Even the acting people can't do much. If it's a serious decision of any kind at all, it's got to go to Washington. And that was very unhandy, being 12 hours out of sync, essentially 11 or 12 hours out of sync with Washington, and 5 hours out of sync with the our headquarters at in Honolulu. My Pacific Air Forces. And Sync Pack also located in Hawaii. They're 6 hours out of sync, so trying to do telecommunications, and of course this was long before cell phones and that sort of thing, although we did have satellite operations working some at that time. Anyway, trying to talk at noon our time, trying to talk to somebody at midnight back in Washington was a pretty unhandy thing to do, so we had to muddle through with all that. Some of the interesting things about the people out of April 29th and 30th out of South Vietnam, One of the C-130s, they were all loaded with the men, women, and kids, where they could get their family in there. But one C-130 had about 120 people on that airplane. It was just amazing to watch them, how they got them shoehorned in there. It was really amazing. The F-5s was a single pilot airplane, but one of those airplanes come in with the pilot and two of his ground crew members. That was interesting, too, to see those three guys get out of the airplane. But, and then, so to help out the United States Air Force, or PACAF, SINCPAC in coordination, wanted to get the Vietnamese out of there. Vietnamese and the Cambodians did not get along. We tried to put them together in our refugee camp, found out that wasn't going to work, so we had to build some separate facilities on a temporary basis. Had one small hangar there, we used that, trying to work around it. The State Department people, like from Bangkok, were really helpful and suggested so forth. They could not make a decision because they didn't have an ambassador there. So that compounded the problem all the way around. But anyway, the combination of Air Force, PACAF, SINCPAC, and so forth, decided to set up a C-141s running through Utapau, and we would move the people, the Vietnamese people, to Guam. So I had 21 C-141s, not all at once, but and in a stream over 2 days, beginning April 30th, running actually not more than one on the ground at a time, and we were sorting out the Vietnamese, make sure where families were involved, we kept them together. Military units were involved, we kept them together, and loaded on C-141s. Running into a bit of a problem, though, we had one small group of Vietnamese Air Force guys decided they didn't want to go to Guam. They want to go back to Saigon.
Hmm.
Well, that wasn't workable at all. So in coordination with the everything from my chaplain to the hospital commander and the State Department guys, too, except they always kept telling me they could not make a decision. They could give a personal opinion, but that was as far as they'd go, and they usually didn't want to do that because without an ambassador, you couldn't do anything about it. So anyway, we wound up sedating some of these guys. I think it wound up being only a total of about 16 that we finally sedated. I put three nurses and a sky cop, one nurse and three sky cops on that last C-141 out of Utapau for Guam to get them out of there. And that was with the, I advised the Brigadier General on duty at PACAF what I was doing. He wouldn't agree or disagree. Caught hell about it the next day, but that's history. But that was a very interesting time. Then the United States DOD decided they wanted to save those F-5s. It was still a relatively new airplane that we had given the Vietnamese. So they said, okay, we'll bring in a Navy carrier, and we'll move those F-5s over to the carrier so they can be brought back to the States. Well, the USS Midway was brought in, see it real easily from the base, setting, I believe, was about 3 miles offshore, maybe four. I'm not sure. I don't much about ships, but it was out far enough so he didn't have so he could anchor out there. And initially, the Marines came in with their helicopters. They're going to haul these F-5s from the base at 4 miles out to the USS Midway. Well, I didn't know anything about F-5s. My guys didn't know anything about F-5s. We scoured their place to find people that might do something about them. But there is a lift point for the F-5, roughly behind the cockpit, where if you've got the right kind of bolts, you can put them in there, and then you can hook on a helicopter or whatever and lift them. There's no problem at all, and move them to, in this case, to the USS Midway. The trouble was we had none of those bolts, of course. We didn't have F-5s at the base. Nobody else in Vietnam, I mean, the area of that part of Thailand had any of those bolts. Well, my engineering guy said, we'll do the best we can. So they went to their bench stock or whatever and come up with something that would fit. Well, they got the first F-5 Marine helicopter, picked it up, and I'm not sure they were handling it very easy, but you got the downdraft of the helicopter. And anyway, we got one airplane to the carrier. The second F-5 that a Marine picked up, he got it about 50 feet in the air. One of those makeshift bolts broke, and that airplane hit the ramp. The third one was already in the process of being hooked up to the Marine helicopter. Lifted it, he got about halfway to the ship and dropped it in the ocean. So that stopped that in a hurry. I'm trying to keep PACAF involved, and again, we're 6 hours out of sync there, so I'm talking to the duty officer.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, my headquarters in the Philippines, my immediate boss that wrote my ER was a fighter guy at Udorn. And anyway, I was told to deal directly with General Manner, who was the 13th Air Force commander in the Philippines. So we're trying to coordinate with the right people on what's going on here. And anyway, they decided to stop that business. They're going to barge the rest of them out to the ship. Well, that upset the captain of the USS Midway. I'm sorry, I don't recall his name, but about 4 or 5 hours after this decision to stop using the helicopters, he was there. He said he could not afford to stay in the Bay of Siam any longer. He'd had to get out of there. Well, that turned out not to be the case. He was overruled on doing that. And he hung around. Well, the Army had some barges over at Sadahib. So eventually over the next 2 days, we got the barges in position. We towed the airplanes down the road. I think it was only about 4 miles down the road to Sadahib, and they were lifted onto the barges, and the rest of them finally got on USS Midway. So about a week after Midway got there, or maybe it was a little longer than a week, the captain finally got the out of there. Anyway, that was an extremely interesting time, and all this going on for about 3 days. We're all very busy. We've got all these airplanes on the ground, and everybody up the line is trying to figure out what to do with them. So I don't recall who all was making those decisions, but all of my people had to be involved, because here we are. We've got airplanes we're not familiar with. But I'll tell you one thing. All the tenant units that had anybody that knew anything about airplanes at all were out there helping. And with the guys I had working for me supervising, they did a super job. We had probably 4 weeks for the last time we got out of there. But within about 5 days, some of the other airplanes began to get moved out. We even had some Air America airplanes come in.
Is that right?
Couldn't account. I don't know whatever happened to those crews. They would get all of a sudden that some of the Air America airplanes were lined up on the ground there, and we'd try to find one of the crew members, and they were gone. But that was what they were supposed to do. So anyway, interesting time.
Hmm. Now, when you get the, I'm going to take you back here a little bit. When you get the word that you could take over as base commander at Utapau, you'd had an awful lot of time in the Air Force by this time. I mean, you were eligible for retirement, I would assume.
Oh, yes, I was. Mm-hmm.
Did you give any thought to going overseas one more time? I mean, now you've got a family, and
absolutely. I told my wife, I said, well, I said, I don't have to accept this assignment. I can retire. But I said, I will go if you will come over to see me a couple of times. We checked out the procedures. In those days, wives, even though they weren't supposed to be over there, come over to commercial airlines, and they could stay 29 days without a visa.
Hmm.
So anyway, my wife agreed. She'd come over a couple of times. I had my daughter was in medical school at the University of Cincinnati. My number two son was in the Air Force Academy at class of 76. So anyway, we decided, she said, okay, she'd do that. And my wife did come over twice. She came over in December the first time and brought my daughter with her. My daughter stayed about 10 days. That's how much time she could afford to be out of school. And my wife was there. She had to go back to March. Or by the way, we were living on base at March, and back in those days, a couple of years later, wives were allowed to stay on base. But anyway, I had to move her into an apartment off base. Well, my son at the academy thought that'd be a great idea to make a trip to Thailand during the Christmas break. So my wife, after spending about 3 weeks over there, returned to the state here so she'd have my number two son could have Christmas with her at March Field or in this area here. And then he would, and of course we had, Young Tiger was the nickname of the transport. We had 135s going through March every day, at least one every day. From March, Hickam, usually the Philippines, and then to Utapau, running every day, moving people, what have you. So I knew all these guys, of course, on both ends, my end as well as one chair at March Field. So I coordinated so my son and his buddy could catch a Young Tiger airplane, come into Utapau, and spend New Year's with me. And then I arranged on Young Tiger to get him going back to March, so he'd get back to the academy in early January. Mm-hmm. So anyway, my wife got back in time, so my number two son and my daughter, by the way, was here also. They spent Christmas with their mother here at just off the base at March. And then caught Young, my number two son, Larry, and his buddy arrived at I don't remember exactly what day it was, but I really enjoyed having them over there for the New Year's celebration. I had those two kids involved, invited to parties, but they hadn't caught up with the jet lag yet, so they wound up both sleeping through the New Year's at Utapau. Mm. But that's another issue. But that was a side issue and very interesting. And then my wife came back in January, and about mid-January, and of course, with all the activity going on with the airlift into Phnom Penh and so forth, on the beginning of the 31st, 31st January is when the Khmer Rouge closed the Mekong at Phnom Penh, and everything went to hell in a handbasket. Anyway, so she stayed another, I think, week or 10 days after the 31st January. I seldom saw her except in the evening. Because I was busy on the ramp all the time, and she'd been over there before, so my house girl took her to Bangkok and that sort of thing, so she had a good time. But that made the years of Samoa worthwhile with my wife coming a couple times. And I don't think she'd ever got to Thailand otherwise. She loved the place. My daughter probably wouldn't got to Thailand otherwise. She loved the place. And my number two son, I don't think he and his buddy that came over for New Year's, they had a unique story to tell when they got back to Colorado Springs, I'm sure.
I'm sure they did as well.
Yeah.
Now, you get over there at a very, like you say, a very interesting time, a very busy, very hectic time there at Utapau. You're, mm-hmm. you're talking about the Khmer Rouge taking over there in Cambodia, essentially. You're talking about the bombing of North Vietnam. You're talking about the, and eventually, the evacuation of Phnom Penh, as well as Saigon there in late April of 1975.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of, and you've talked about some of these things briefly, but what kind of activities did you see as a result of these things? You mentioned the blockade. You've talked about these other issues. What was it like to be the base commander at this base that was incredibly busy at this time, even though the American part of the war, for all intents and purposes, was obviously over back in 72 and 73. What was, for example, what was the daily routine like? What was the mission, the number of missions being flown out? Tell me about those things in some detail, if you can.
Well, I guess I'm being approached this way. I told you I had 18 tenant units altogether, SAC being the biggest tenant unit, of course, and then MAC being next largest with their routine. By the way, they did an awful lot of airlift support, bringing materials into my base for subsequent shipment elsewhere and within Thailand, you know, in support of a lot of things. So we had 141s, 1 to 3 every day coming in routinely. So that was busy. The C-130s, I'm not sure what all they were doing, but they were busy. And, of course, that usual 135 B-52 activity all the time. So it was a very busy base constantly. But I had some fantastic people working for me. They were good people, everything from the operations guys to the civil engineering. And, of course, the civil engineering had a good time because they had old Red Horse Squadron. There were some 500 people in that Red Horse outfit that could always been called on to do anything had to do with engineering or whatever. So that was all very nice. We had a meeting before everything come unglued in January, late January. I had a meeting of all the tenant units once a week. We would sit down. We had a lot of guys that were there to just in case things got worse. So as a result, they had a lot of time on their hands. So disciplinary problems. While I was the court-martial authority on base, I didn't have to court-martial too many people, but enough to take some time, and of course it kept my cops and the intel people busy, and the OSI, the Office of Special Investigations, those guys busy. I had to do a lot of coordination with them from a disciplinary standpoint. Although in comparison to other places I had been, it wasn't that bad there, but with 18 tenant units and 6,000 military, it was time consuming.
Mm-hmm.
So that occupied quite a bit of our time once a week when I had all the 18 tenant units represented at a meeting to swap ideas, one thing or another, about what we could do better and this sort of thing. But it was always a busy time. The meeting was scheduled for 1 hour, but it usually lasted about two, working on problems. And I had nobody fight with each other. That was the greatest thing. Everybody seemed to coordinate with everybody, and I made sure that anybody could come into my office anytime with any kind of problem. They didn't have to clear it with anybody. And so that kind of procedures, I think, worked real well. There was some turnover of commanders. You know, basically that was a one-year tour, although it was not, I don't know, the different organization handled things differently. My personnel problems were not that much, and I had a good crew to take care of that one too. So routine day-to-day activity, we're working. We had a two-shift operation, basically, even though we're supposed to operate 24/7. We had basically a two-shift operation on most of the units on the base, and a lot of that was just in case. You know, we're, like I say, people had time on their hands, because unless something, now once things started coming unglued at the end of January and we started the airlift, those kind of things, it got real busy, and that was good because people had something to do instead of standing around getting in trouble.
Right, right. Now you talk about the airlift. Your experience with the Berlin airlift, of course, I would assume would have some sort of impact on your
I suppose it did, Kelly, but you know, I was an airplane driver in the Berlin airlift as a first lieutenant, and here I'm the commander. My problem of flying airplanes and so forth had nothing to do with it.
Right.
So all the coordination we had to do was, and had to, like I say, people just stepped up to do whatever we could. That trained those loading crews with all the cooperation from the MAC guys and the number of people volunteering to do it was an interesting operation. You know, like I say, we eliminated, this is based at a meeting of the whole group, by the way, we eliminated the the patches and so forth of one unit or another one by, they could wear their baseball cap with their unit number on it, but otherwise their shirt was a white T-shirt. So I'm making a big deal out of that, but it was a big deal. You know, guys get attached to their units, and they want to advertise it when they're around other units.
Sure.
So that was it was interesting. We got over the hump pretty quick on that one, though. That white T-shirt thing seemed to solve the problem.
Right, just taking care of the possible disciplinary issues and
well, I had
morale.
Quite a few disciplinary issues. I don't know whether it's appropriate in this context or not, but had a number of whorehouses active in the local area that took care of the troops, you know. And as far as the disciplinary problem, my chief cop and I used to go down sometimes once a week, usually once every 2 weeks, and have dinner with the madams.
Hmm.
And that helped out a whole lot because we were able to, and I take my hospital guys, one of the doctors too, with us every once in a while. We sit down and talk to the madams about how our troops need to be safe. We can't stop them from coming to your place of business, but we want to try to keep them as healthy as we can.
Sure.
So that turned out to be a pretty interesting thing, too. As a matter of fact, when my wife was over there, I think it was the second time, I invited her to come to dinner with the madams one night with us. And
is that right?
A chief cop and I. And she got a big kick out of it. She really did. She wanted to tour one of the whorehouses.
Huh.
And one of the madams accommodated.
I'll
it was
be
so
darn.
Interesting. My wife, being had a little sheltered life her whole life, so it was something interesting for her to see.
I would bet it would be. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, that was just another thing that, and by the way, these weren't my ideas. We looked for ideas wherever they could come from, and
sure.
We tried some that worked and some that didn't work. But that was one that worked out very well with the madams. They looked forward to it, as I did too, once every 2 weeks, sometimes do it once a week.
Mm-hmm. Now you're also there while things, like you say, are falling apart, with Phnom Penh needing to be evacuated, Saigon needing to be evacuated. What was your feeling, your reaction to all of this finally coming to an end there in 1975? Mm-hmm. From the vantage point you had there, Utapau, what were your feelings on this?
Well, trying to keep up with what was going on, it just got overwhelmed. I don't recall for sure, but I doubt any of those airplanes actually coordinated with the tower. Fortunately, the weather was good on the 29th and 30th both. So the biggest problem the Vietnamese had was just getting enough, having enough fuel and so forth to get to the Utapau.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you, the orderliness of the military, most of the military guys was great. The Vietnamese, I sound like a little negative sometimes on the Vietnamese, but the F-5 fighter unit, for example, when they all got on the ground, the commander, a colonel, which, by the way, he spoke very good English, and I used him in several occasions over the next few days, he had those pilots assembled just like they would if they had flown a mission back in the war, and counted off and covered down, so to speak, and all the crews, the Vietnamese crews, were looking for somebody to, what do you want us to do now?
Hmm.
So for the most part, there were some exceptions, but for the most part, it's pretty orderly operation. We're trying to get everybody, keep everybody out of the sun. You know, it's hot,
sure.
Humid in Cambodia. I mean, in Saigon and Vietnam, all that area, including Thailand, it's a tropical climate. So trying to get the women and kids especially to make sure they're out of the sun while we're deciding what to do with them and feeding them. My guys chipped in, and we brought food to them. We didn't want to get them out of the off the flight line. So we brought food to them and made sure they all got to eat. And I had some of the nurses out of the hospital were fantastic. They took care of the kids to make sure they had the right kind of food for the kids and that sort of thing. Actually, I just nothing but praise for all the people who were assigned to Utapau at that time, chipped in and did good things.
Mm. So when do you finally come back to the States for good after this?
Well, my daughter was graduating from medical school at the University of Cincinnati. I don't remember the exact date, But I asked to leave 2 weeks early, and my replacement, they arranged for that. I made that request, a month or so before the time was due. Anyway, my replacement got in there okay. The site guys were really nice to me. They set up a 135 just for me. Loaded my stuff on board, some peak wood I'd bought, my wife and I'd bought at Chiang Mai, and things like that on the 135, and I had my own airplane coming back to March. My guys I'd let that worked for me here at March, by the way, at 15th Air Force Headquarters, had my old job back when after a little leave here. But come back to the States, and my wife got leave, of course, and my wife and I drove back to Cincinnati for my daughter's graduation from medical school. All four of my kids there were there for that. So that was interesting. And then back to March, and back to March, 15th Air Force Headquarters, back to my old job again and on the staff. I was going to retire within 6 months. Well, it wound up I did not retire in 6 months because the General Wilson, who was the commander of PACAF at the time all this collapsed, gave me an unsatisfactory ER.
Is that right?
After sedating these guys to put them into Guam, they raised much hell about it and so forth. So I had a lot of help, site guys, as they ain't no way with all the things I'd been through in my career and so on. By the way, I wound up getting what's the medal? For my duty to base commander, duty pal, I got I'm drawing a blank on the decoration. I'll come up with it in a minute. Anyway.
That's all right.
The guys here at March and SAC headquarters both said we're not going to stand for that, so they challenged it. Ultimately, no need to go through any gory details, but ultimately the ER was withdrawn, and I got a clean belly health from it, and all the way through it. Got a Legion of Merit, that's what I was trying to think of. I got a Legion of Merit for my tour. That was my third one, by the way, I got for my tour, time as a base commander at Utapau in Thailand. So, everything ended okay. The site guys backed me 100%. They knew what was going on. We had enough people around to figure that out. And like I say, I've said many times before, I'd do the same thing again under the same circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So when do you finally retire, Colonel?
I retired. I wound up staying and retired. And actually, it took. Started my terminal leave in October of 76. My official retirement date was 1 January 77.
Okay, in 1977.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been in the military for a very long time.
33 years and about 4 months. I started went in the military in the Air Vice Cadet program on 3 September of 43 and retired officially 1 January 77.
Okay. Now, this question may be too broad to answer, so answer it however you see fit. But over those years, from 1943 until your retirement in 1977, you had a tremendous and varied career. How did you see the military change throughout that time, internally?
Well, there was a lot of changes, from, I guess, one of the biggest changes was early in my career, and I didn't think too much about that until later on, looking back on the change from Army to Air Force. There's a lot of significant things that went on there, and just, how we transitioned was very interesting. I suppose the other significant things that worried me an awful lot, I could not understand why the people who participated in the Vietnam War had such a negative reception back here in the States. I think none of us military guys, after all, I was involved from the time I was in the Joint Staff in the Pentagon for the JCS staff to my time at in and out of country on temporary duty, and then my time at Utapau. I just couldn't understand why the I hate to blame it on President Johnson, but I think he was part of the problem. But you know, we had such a negative attitude. There was no interesting reception at all on the guys coming back from their time in Vietnam. I don't care what service you were in. Compare that with returning from Iran and from Iraq rather, and the Cambodian troops. The reception we have nowadays, it's a totally different ball game. So looking back on it, at the time, I couldn't understand why being a military guy during the Vietnam War was so bad. That was, I guess, one of the worst feelings I ever had about the military being treated that way.
Right. Well, one last question for you, I guess, Colonel. And, again, a very broad question, but what do you think were the most important lessons that the United States should have taken away from the Vietnam War experience? What lessons should we have learned?
Well, that's a tough one. Although in my experience, particularly in Joint Staff, we discussed that a lot. And then later on, back at reunion, that sort of thing, we always figured we had to deal with McNamara's quiz kids, and McNamara, who turned out to be one of the worst sectors of defense the country's ever had. That was a bad thing when we in the military thought we were supposed to be winning that war. I spent, as we covered previously in this discussion, so much time updating war plans and all that sort of thing of what we should have done in Vietnam and were not allowed to do because the politicians, for some reason or other, I guess they were afraid China was going to come in, the Soviets or something, because after all they had supplied North Vietnamese with virtually all their military hardware. Couldn't understand why we shouldn't be winning at war. Now, I'll bet the people nowadays are as frustrated in a little different direction with the Iraq was probably handled properly for a while. It finally got off track a little bit. I think same thing in probably is going on right now in Afghanistan. But back to my time frame, we didn't know how to do an insurgency war, and that's essentially the only kind of wars we've had since. And I don't know how that could have been done better. I know the Air Force has been, in my opinion, has been grossly misused in Iraq and Afghanistan both. We're wearing out equipment, wearing out people, and everything else. And I don't know firsthand, but it just appears to me that it's been has not been used efficiently as it should have been. Same thing in Vietnam. We had the ability early in the war in Vietnam to take out North Vietnam. There wasn't any two ways about it. Without A-bomb, didn't need these nuclear weapons, didn't do that at all. But as time went on, it got harder and harder to do. Then maybe by the time we finally settled the war there, I'm not sure we could have won it militarily anymore. But the frustration was awful in the Pentagon among us guys that we're working long hours, many times 7 days a week, and keep on thinking, well, okay, we're finally going to do something that we ought to be doing. And yet the politicians stopped. So that was the frustrating time frame for me.
Right. Well, Colonel, is there anything else you would like to add to this interview before we bring it to a close?
I don't think so, Kelly. What I would certainly volunteer to do, if it looks like we've left out something or any further questions, I'd be glad to try to fill them in.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, Colonel, thank you so much for your time. I really
do appreciate
it.
It's been a real
sir.
Pleasure, Kelly, working with you.
All right. Well, terrific.